This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So how complicated is the immune system? It's so complicated that even though doctors like to make parents think they know what the immune system is all about, they still to this day know very little. The immune system tests that doctors use on patients today are pretty much the same as the tests they used 50 years ago.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Today's show, vaccination, enough to make you sick. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys is a medical doctor, internist, and board-certified nephrologist currently in private practice. She is co-author of Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. Currently, the California legislature is fast-tracking two vaccine Senate bills. Senate Bill 277 will eliminate the personal belief and religious exemptions from vaccines required for children to attend public and private school. Senate Bill 792 will require CDC-prescribed adult immunization of child care workers, with the exception of flu vaccine. Today we review some of the elements of Dr. Suzanne Humphreys' video, Honesty versus Policy, available on her YouTube channel, with a special emphasis on vaccine efficacy. She continues to dispel the mythology surrounding vaccination. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, welcome again.
Thank you, Bonnie, and thank you for having me back on the show.
Many people listening to this program may not have heard our first interview, so I'd like you to again describe your medical training and experience as a practicing physician. You are a board-certified nephrologist, a researcher, and author. What is a nephrologist?
Okay, a nephrologist is an internal medicine specialty. So after medical school, I went and did a 3-year residency program in internal medicine. And then after that, I studied for 2 more years in something called a fellowship, which gives me a specialty in the field of internal medicine. So I studied kidneys, and the subspecialty of nephrology really covers a bit of endocrinology, high blood pressure, metabolic disorders, electrolyte disorders, and lots of interesting things like that. And we do a lot of kidney replacement therapies, such as dialysis and transplantation.
Could you talk about the recent famous or infamous measles outbreak at Disneyland in California? That took place at the beginning of this year. What are the facts? What do we know about this measles outbreak, and who was affected by it?
Sure. It was really interesting, actually, because I was actually not in America when this started. I was in New Zealand, and the reverberations were felt worldwide. And I really believe that that was part of the intention of the media blast that we were all hit with. But as of April 17, 2015, there were 136 confirmed cases of measles in the state of California. There were more than that outside of California. But what I do have, because you don't always get the breakdown of vaccinated versus unvaccinated, but in the California cases, we have that. So we have 136 confirmed cases. 57 of those were unvaccinated, 25 were vaccinated, and 54 were unknown. So what we should realize is that 18% of those cases were vaccinated, and nearly half of them we actually don't know the status. But what's most interesting is how the media spun this. And an exact quote that we heard over and over and over was, "The majority of 159 cases with reported measles in the 2015 outbreaks were either unvaccinated or had unknown vaccination status." And I could have just as easily taken those statistics and said, "The majority of the 159 patients with reported measles in the 2015 outbreaks were either vaccinated or had unknown vaccination status," because the fact is that the unknowns were a very large proportion of that group. Yes, there were more unvaccinated than known vaccinated. So, you know, that is one of the risks of not taking a vaccine, is that you are more likely to get the more common diseases. Now, I'm not somebody who's ever going to tell you that vaccines don't do anything. They actually do something. They can prevent transmission of a disease. And in the case of of measles, how they do it is basically by giving children an injection of a modified measles virus, a live virus. So you're basically giving them a specialized case of measles in order to prevent the wild measles. And these vaccines only last for a short period of time. But the facts are that measles in Disneyland was an insignificant spark in a teacup, and it was blown up into a draconian, hysteria-packed flame. And I believe it was in order to energize what is an already planned nationwide wildfire type legislation, which primarily destroys the rights of people to make personal choices for themselves and their own families. So who was affected by the California outbreak? I say potentially the whole world, because the rest of the world tends to adopt USA policy. And while I was abroad, I heard discussions taking place in Australia and New Zealand. There's talks in Northern Europe now about countries considering mandating vaccinations. And so it will probably happen in many of those countries. And the weirdest thing to me is that we live in the most highly vaccinated world ever. And that includes California. And many people are surprised to learn that California has a measles, mumps, rubella vaccination rate of approximately 96.1% among pre-kindergarten children. It's the highest that it's ever been, and it actually exceeds the national arbitrary goal of 95%. And I recommend that people go online and read a blog by Dr. Edward Yazbek in Vaccination News. And in there, he goes through a lot of the breakdown of what really is going on in the country. And what he says also is that it's a sad reality that no one mentioned that over 1,500 autism cases may have been diagnosed during the 24 first days of that measles outbreak. And that according to the 2014-2015 California Department of Public Health Child Care Immunization Assessment results, that 89.4% of the 434,000 children 2 years to 4 years and 11 months of age enrolled in reporting child care facilities received all required immunizations. There's a 0.56% of children with permanent medical exemptions, and there's only a 2.67% personal belief exemption rate, and that is actually down from the rate in 2013 and 2014. The MMR vaccination rate is actually up from what was last year. It's actually better than the rates for DPT, polio, hepatitis B, and varicella. Yet the news would have us believing that measles is worse than Ebola and that we have a national crisis. I mean, it's really mind-boggling when you look at the statistics. And the CDC actually surveyed exemptions among kindergarten students in 2012 to 2013, and anyone can go online and read about this. An editor of this report stated, quote, "An exemption does not necessarily imply a child was not vaccinated. More than 99% of the 2006-2007 birth cohorts who became kindergartners in 2012 to 13 received at least one vaccine," unquote. Yet what we hear in California is that it's the unvaccinated, these educated hippie parents, you know, who are going on to create a wildfire throughout the world by not vaccinating their children. And if you actually look at the numbers, that's far from the reality. But there's a big concern that people are becoming more educated and starting to reject vaccination as a result of their education.
What is the difference between natural immunity and the protection that comes from vaccinations?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, natural immunity is first driven by what's called cell-mediated immunity, which then brings in every facet of the body's immune system. And what that does is it creates a properly programmed, durable, multifaceted form of protection. You know, lots of people think that immunity is a synonym for antibody, but the more we learn about the immune system, the more we know that that's simply not true. If you look at the case of measles, we wrote about this in Dissolving Illusions, but there are people who have a disorder, or I should say an aberration, called A-gamma globulinemia. It's a big, long word, but it basically means that they can't make antibodies. Their body just doesn't make antibodies. And the funny thing is that they deal perfectly normal with measles. And scientists know that those people have lifelong immunity just like normal people. So it's very interesting, isn't it, that, you know, what we do is we measure antibodies to see that someone's immune to measles, yet people that don't make antibody at all not only deal with measles perfectly fine, but they remain immune. And this is important because every infection we can have is first tackled by what's called the cell-mediated immune system, and that's driven by good nutrition. People who have a bad response to measles or even long-term problems after the infection, the reason is because their cell-mediated frontline immune system doesn't work properly and that it refuses to stomp on and throw the measles virus out of their body. So if you have someone with AIDS, for instance, they're going to have a terrible time. If you have someone with cancer, they're going to have a terrible time. If you have somebody who has their cell-mediated immune system paralyzed because they're on steroid drugs or anti-cancer drugs, then they're going to basically have a really hard time with any sort of disease that requires their cell-mediated immunity, and measles is one of them. If children are actually formula-fed and not breastfed, we know that breastfed babies have a much better control of their cell-mediated immune systems, and moreover, they have better cell-mediated response even to the vaccine. There's a study by PABST, PAPST, that talks about this. So when we talk about vaccine immunity in terms of measles or whooping cough, we have to consider the route of infection versus the route of vaccination. And that, in my opinion, is one of the most important facets of what distinguishes natural immunity from the so-called protection that we get from vaccinations. And I'm just going to give you an example using whooping cough now, because I think this is really fascinating. And that is, if a person is infected with whooping cough, their primary immunity begins at the lungs, at the site where the infection occurs. And they develop a very brisk response, and they will maintain their immunity for about 35 years. Now, if you compare that to somebody who's been vaccinated, their immunity is going to start at the injection site, and it's going to start far away from the lungs. And secondarily, the lungs will have some form of immunity. And what happens later on is that, A, that vaccine wears off. But more importantly, if you compare a person who has recovered from the natural whooping cough infection to somebody who has been vaccinated, even freshly vaccinated, with the highest level of immunity they can have from that vaccine, and you expose both of those groups to the whooping cough bacteria, what is going to happen is that the person with natural immunity, you will not be able to culture bacteria from their lungs and they will have no symptoms. The person who has been vaccinated, you will be able to culture bacteria from their lungs for up to 6 weeks. So this means that they're harboring bacteria, perhaps asymptomatically, perhaps with a mild cough. They're not isolated from society. They're going around spreading bacteria to the people that are supposedly the most vulnerable. So while the vaccine can maybe protect you for a short period of time, when you look at that fact that's been shown by a researcher named Warfel using baboons, which is an incredibly good model for humans and pertussis, this is what those studies show. So that really, to me, highlights the difference between vaccine immunity and natural immunity.
Is there proof that vaccination actually does what it claims? That is, does vaccination immunize?
Well, you know, a lot of people like to say vaccination is an immunization. But if you actually talk to immunologists about what the definition of immunize is, that vaccines do immunize in the sense that they cause a response in the immune system that can lead to recognition of something in the future. So technically, they immunize, but do they protect? And that's really the question. But the proof that vaccines immunize is presented to the public in two different ways. In clinical trials in a restricted group of super healthy people who make a surrogate marker to a disease through the vaccine. And that surrogate marker is antibody, which they say protects. But we just reviewed with measles that it necessarily isn't necessary. The second way is when the official statistics say that people aren't going to doctors with that disease anymore. And sometimes that's because the disease did go down in its natural form for different reasons. And sometimes it's because doctors don't consider that disease because they assume the vaccine took it away. So this so-called proof isn't foolproof. Literally, because I've lost count of the numbers of people who come to me who have had whooping cough, for instance, but the doctor won't consider it. Or these people have been diagnosed with five other things first and mistreated with antibiotics, antivirals, you name it, inhalers, diagnosed with gastric reflux. I mean, I've pretty much seen it all at this point. And so they're treated for diseases they don't have before the diagnosis may finally be made, or they never actually do make the diagnosis. The people that come to me usually figure it out on their own and say, my doctor said this isn't, and what do you think? And often I'll say, just go get a swab and go get tested, and they will be. So also there are parents who just keep quiet, and they keep their kids at home when they get measles, and they never report it so as not to draw attention to themselves. So that also is going to skew your reporting of disease rates. But furthermore, there are many cases in the medical literature of people who have very high levels of surrogate markers for protection who go on to get that disease. And tetanus is a really good example where some of the most severe cases of tetanus have antibody levels which are sky high and according to science should have protected them. So that's one example of how the vaccine would supposedly immunize a person, but it didn't protect them.
I'm speaking with physician, researcher, and author Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Today's show, Vaccination, Enough to Make You Sick. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Then we have a whole other issue called serotype replacement, where Gardasil is a really good example for that because, you know, these 9 to 12-year-olds were told that they needed Gardasil injections. A lot of their parents complied. And what we've now found is that while the Gardasil injection is actually very good at immunizing against those four strains of the virus, what's happened is that in the children, they're now older teenagers and young adults who were vaccinated, we're finding that they have twice the rate of risk of infection with other serotypes that are not included in the vaccine yet have risk to cause the kind of changes in cells that can turn cancerous. So what's happened is that you've basically put these kids at a higher risk for types of the virus that are not in the vaccine because you've wiped out what was normally in the population. And this is called serotype replacement. We see this with the pneumococcal vaccines. People might know that they started out with 7 strains in the first vaccine, and because other strains came in, because there's a total of 90 strains, then they move in and they can cause worse problems than the original strains, something called empyema, which is basically pus pocket in the lung. And so people can get very sick from other types, even though the vaccine did its job. And so now we have a 13 strain pneumococcal vaccine. And it won't be long before children are being given more strains in their vaccine. Adults have a 23-strain vaccine. So this is just what happens because even though a vaccine can be very successful at hitting its target, that doesn't necessarily mean that you've protected the person because the immune system is so complicated and because the biome structure of basically of the world, of what's around us, is not so simple.
What are the criteria or studies to back up claims of vaccine effectiveness?
Okay, well, I think I'd like to just talk about the flu vaccine for starters, because there's a very well-organized system to evaluate what studies exist in order to support or refute the protectiveness of the influenza vaccines. And that's called the Cochrane Collaborative Database. This is a very well-respected organization that reviews all studies available to make conclusions whether or not interventions are valid or whether there's good support for the intervention. One of the leading investigators for the influenza vaccine in that organization is named Dr. Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, Dr. Thomas Jefferson is not an anti-vaccine doctor. He's actually pro-vaccine. However, when he looked at the flu vaccine data and compared that to the publicity and the hype that we see in the world today, he was very upset. And when the Vancouver Sun interviewed him in 2012, he was quoted the following, which I think really tells it all. He said, "Following this perverted logic would have inactivated vaccines saving lives from accidents, strokes, accidental poisoning, hypothermia, and falls, but not from influenza and pneumonia. Either the inactivated vaccines are miracle workers or there is something very wrong with the evidence. Cochrane reviews weigh the evidence by its quality, not by their conclusions." So he's well aware that the conclusions are usually pre-made and then the so-called science or studies are designed in order to prove the predetermined conclusions. So for the sake of clarity, let's discuss baby vaccines for a bit. The criteria are easily seen on a website called clinicaltrials.gov, clinicaltrials.gov for any vaccine. Those trials mainly go like this. They'll take a base population, say 2,000 babies. And what they'll do is they'll eliminate babies that had a traumatic delivery. They'll eliminate babies from a normal delivery if they're under a certain weight. They'll eliminate babies with developing health issues. They'll eliminate babies whose mother has an autoimmune disease or disorder, which is likely to affect the baby in any way. Eliminate babies born to a normal mother who seems to have an immune system problem. They'll eliminate every sick baby or baby taking certain drugs. Babies who, in the opinion of the researcher, need to be eliminated from the study. This is the waste paper basket for anything unforeseen that they didn't think of beforehand. The result is that the study population might now be around 900 babies, which now bears no resemblance to the neonatal population at ground zero who will be recommended this vaccine. Then they'll find a similar control group of babies with radiant health who will receive all standard vaccines except the target vaccine. It also bears no resemblance to the population at ground zero. Okay, once we have those two groups set, they do the study. Then they eliminate any study babies that, quote, don't adhere to protocol, which covers an array of problems, which I don't have time to get into. They'll pronounce that in this unique handpicked group of babies that the vaccine is safe and effective, and then legislate that to be given to everyone at ground zero, including the very babies that were eliminated from the trial in the first place. So that's how many vaccine effectiveness or safety trials are done. With the new pending California law, babies with birth defects that trials may never have been done on will still be mandated to have the vaccines. People with seizure disorders, family history of problems such as seizure disorders, genetic predispositions, history of vaccine reactions, and many of the groups who are prone to have a hard time after vaccines will still be told they have to have vaccinations anyway.
Even the Center for Disease Control admits that vaccines are not 100% effective. Do different vaccines have different effectiveness rates? Do they wear off?
Well, every person vaccinated will have a different response to that same vaccine. It all depends on the person's genetics, and it also depends on lifestyle factors. For instance, drug addicts who wreck their immune system by injecting will not have the same sort of cell-mediated and antibody response to a tetanus vaccine as someone who's eating well and living normally. We also know that diabetics tend to have less of a response. We know that people with chronic kidney disease, so there are lots of kind of knowable underlying disorders, and then there are lots of things that we really don't know about until after a vaccine has been given, which makes us not all equal. So in the 1990s, the vaccinated but homeless alcoholics in Russia had a vastly higher case fatality rate from diphtheria than the vaccinated normal people who had a home and didn't make themselves comatose with alcohol. So that's just another factor that we know has come into play with regard to whether or not people get the disease, whether they're vaccinated or not. Even within a so-called normal population, though, there's a wide range of so-called protection by any one vaccine, from barely detectable antibodies to levels much higher than the majority of the vaccinated. And that's not determined by the vaccine a lot of that time. It's determined by the health and the prior immunologic experience of the person that vaccine was given to. And yes, different vaccines have different success rates for their intended goal, and the vaccines do wear off. All of them eventually wear off, and they wear off at different times depending on which vaccine you're talking about.
I believe I read in an article about your book, Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History, that the practice of vaccination was developed before the immune system was fully, or even for that matter, partially understood. Is this the case? And if so, what are the implications when analyzing both vaccine safety and vaccine effectiveness? How complicated is the immune system?
Okay. Well, as you know, our book is a history book, and so we had a bit of information about that in there. And Edward Jenner is the guy. He's not a doctor by any means. He's not even a scientist, but he was the guy who invented the smallpox vaccines in the late 1700s. And back in his day, they didn't have a clue what a white blood cell was or anything else. Doctors had no formal training, and they empirically made conclusions on what they thought they saw with their eyes. So Jenner's so-called experiments that were totally uncontrolled, meaning they had no control group, those conclusions are not worth much at all as far as what Jenner's experiments were. But often doctors in those days were no more knowledgeable than parents were. And often parents had more skills and sense than doctors did. In Dissolving Illusions, we wrote about the home remedies that were very helpful in the smallpox times. But today, that's considered quackery. Yet arm-to-arm vaccinations and stabbing pus from infected cow udders into an infant's skin was considered state-of-the-art. Funny enough, the scientists in the 1600s and 1700s who were actually beginning to use microscopes to examine body elements and microbes were considered nut jobs at the time. So how complicated is the immune system? It's so complicated that even though doctors like to make parents think they know what the immune system is all about, they still to this day know very little. The immune system tests that doctors use on patients today are pretty much the same as the tests they used 50 years ago. And while the research world is right on to something called genomics and vaccinomics in the broad sense, which has the ability to look deeper at the issue, that has little impact at ground zero in helping parents actually deal with issues. Let me give you an example. Up until a few days ago, the average doctor will have believed that the brain didn't have lymphatic drainage system, and also that the brain was privileged, which means that it was somehow magically exempt from rejecting things that the rest of the body would toss out. But a couple of weeks ago, a paper was published in the journal Nature by a scientist named Louveau, L-O-U-V-E-A-U, which showed that, guess what, the brain does have a lymphatic system. Pretty amazing. I mean, here we are in 2015, where the human body is supposedly all mapped out, and they missed the lymphatic system that surrounds the brain and drains the brain. If you look at pictures in all the old textbooks, which are going to have to be rewritten, the lymphatic system ends at the top of the neck. And I just always used to think, well, how can that be? How can the most important organ of the body not have a lymphatic drainage system? Well, because the research community assumed that everything had been mapped by the middle of the last century. So this research turns a whole lot of other assumptions on their heads, and some of those assumptions are directly relevant to children who, after vaccination, experience inflammation and other problems in their brains that doctors constantly deny could be caused by vaccines. If the brain has a lymphatic system, it must need that lymphatic system, right? The brain is not as isolated and protected from the happenings of the rest of the body that we have been told that it is. And the other thing is that it's a reality that mapping something isn't the end point. So the anatomical mapping is what I'm talking about. You can look at a computer, a keyboard, and a screen, and if you don't understand how that computer works, you're not going to be able to use very much on that computer. And if you want to change how that computer functions, you have to understand the software quite well, not just the mouse and the keyboard. And vaccination basically rewrites the software of the immune system. And in my opinion, that makes it less functional in the long run. With the body, there's an assumption that everything in there is already named and understood, and that's just not the case. As a nephrologist, there are many conditions which retreat where we're flying blind because we can't fully understand the condition. We know where the problem is and what it looks like under a microscope, but we actually have few clues as to why the problem started or how to reverse the process. And so what we do as nephrologists is we really just try to, you know, immunosuppress a person to get this disease to stamp out. But that doesn't mean that we understand it at all. And most of these diseases I'm talking about in nephrology are immunologically mediated diseases, but we still don't understand them. There's so much that isn't known about the functions of the body and what can make it go wrong that much of what we do is still empirical and flying blind. And when you consider how thoughtlessly the medical system tosses cluster bombs of any sort into the complex human ecosystem that they don't understand, it's pretty amazing. But most people don't really get that truth and depth and fact until after something goes wrong when they're under the care of the medical system.
I'm speaking with physician, researcher, and author Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Today's show, Vaccination, Enough to Make You Sick. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Dr. Humphreys, you have mentioned several times the cell-mediated immune system, but
yes.
But you write about another part of the immune system called the humoral immune system. What's the difference?
Okay. The cell-mediated immune system are basically the attack cells that are ready and waiting all the time. It's the reason every time you have a new cold virus or a new bacteria that you've never met before that starts to invade your body, that you don't die from it. Think about it. I mean, if you had to have the kind of immunity that vaccines supposedly give, and if you had to have the kind of immunity that that you get after you've been infected with something, we wouldn't survive anything, right? Because you have to first survive the disease in order to get that memory immunity. So how is that disease survived without that memory immunity is by macrophages and killer lymphocytes. That's what I mean by cell-mediated immunity, cells like that that are already there and ready and waiting to do the job, okay? Okay, and so that's the cell-mediated immune system. The humoral immune system, humoral just means antibody. And antibodies come from cells, but they also exist in and of themselves circulating in our bodies. So we all have levels of different types of antibodies like immune globulin A called IgA, immune globulin G, IgG, and IgM, for instance. So we all have that right now circulating around. We don't necessarily need a vaccine or an illness for that because it's just a normal part of the immune system development to have low levels of these certain immune globulins. And they do provide some help in the total orchestration of immunity. But those are two different arms of immunity. And after a vaccine is given, what scientists measure most is the antibody. And what I'm saying is that it's not necessarily the antibody that protects us. What happens with IgG antibody, for instance, is that that's actually the last thing that happens when you get sick. So when you get measles, the first thing that happens is your lymphocytes are alerted. And then the measles is spreading through the body. And then more of your lymphocytes are alerted because it gets into different cells that have to be killed. You actually have to kill your own cells in order to kill the measles virus. And then as this process is happening, you're making different types of antibody. So first you're making IgM, and then later you're making the IgG. So it's not possible that your IgG is protecting you, given that it's the last thing that happens. Yet it's the focus of, it's the surrogate marker for immunity. When we know better now today, we know that we can measure cytokines, which tell us they're basically communication molecules, which tell us what cells are active in a person. Yet that's not routinely done when looking at whether a person is immune or not after a vaccine.
So, Dr. Humphreys, are you essentially saying then that what is usually looked at are antibodies, but that they don't tell the whole story at all?
Absolutely. And that's all that's looked at. It's called titers. So if you look at all the vaccine science, and if you look at, you know, whether if you want to get opt out of a vaccine yourself, what they'll do is they'll draw blood, and then they take that blood and they expose it to cells that are infected with the virus, for instance. So they're able to see if your blood is able to stop those cells from getting infected. And that's one way they can test it. So there are other ways that they can test what your, quote, titer is. It's not a direct measurement. It's kind of an indirect measurement of how much antibody you have circulating. But whether or not that antibody specifically is protecting you is still a bit of an unknown. It's not an exact measurement. There's really no great exact measurement of a person's immunity by looking in the blood. All we can really do is gather clues, but we know for certain that it's the cell-mediated immunity that fights off the disease of measles, and so it would make much more sense to have a measurement of what cells of yours and how many of those cells have been activated and primed and can remember that particular disease. But that is not something that's routinely done, even though we do have the technology. Again, it's some of it's indirect and some of it's direct technology to be able to measure those things. We're still looking at antibodies. So it's a pretty antiquated way that we're looking at people's blood to see whether or not they're immune, either from a vaccine or from having the actual disease.
Could you talk about the use of Cocker Spaniel kidneys in the production of vaccines? Is this a safe procedure? What does the term immortal or continuous line mean in this context?
Okay. Yes, it sounds like a pretty crazy concept, doesn't it? But it's not. It's actually happening. These Cocker Spaniel kidney cells were taken out of Cocker Spaniels, I believe it was in the 1950s, by two scientists named Madin, M-A-D-I-N, and Darby. And at the time, you know, they were just looking for a cell line that they could culture out and would stay good enough that they could do different experiments on it. Well, over time, and we don't really know how, but these same cell lines, this Madin Darby cell substrate, has become immortal. And that basically means that it's turned tumorigenic. And this is not something I made up. You know, this is written about in textbooks. It's also written by the FDA. The FDA says nobody knows how these cells were made immortal. But I can tell you that I can only speculate, but the textbooks clearly state that an oncogenic transformation occurred and that there was a chromosomal mutation. So it basically means that these normal Cocker Spaniel kidney cells somehow, and you can do this by radiating them, you can do them by exposing them to different chemicals, but they became mutants and became cancer cells. And this is very handy when you want to have what's called an immortal cell line. These bio companies can just keep selling these tumor cells, these tumor cell lines to different labs, and they'll just grow so perfectly and beautifully and aggressively that it's a really easy way to do experiments and to grow vaccine on. So in order to understand further what I'm going to explain, you have to understand that in order to make a vaccine, like, say, a flu vaccine, you have to find a way to grow the flu virus. You know, it just doesn't magically happen that you get two antigens from the influenza vaccine and are able to put it in salt water and inject it. So what they used to do is they used to inject chicken eggs. But that's very time-consuming and costly, and there are problems associated with chicken viruses that can come along for the ride. So they needed a way to do things quicker and cheaper. And what they did is they said, hey, let's try these Madin Darby kidney cells because they're cheap, they're easy. We don't need to, wait a whole year to get things up and running. And so they started experimenting, and they found that they worked really well to grow the flu vaccine in. And then what you do is you harvest your influenza virus, and then you kill it, and then you extract the antigens that you want. But the problem is that you can never extract just the pieces that you want. There's always going to be some genetic material from whatever cell lines you grew it on. There's always going to be some leftovers from the media that you use to keep those cells alive, which usually contains animal blood. There's usually going to be something left over from the trypsin that they get from pig intestine, or pig pancreas, rather. And so there's many animal substrates used to make these vaccines. So they use these tumorigenic kidney cells to make a flu vaccine, and it's been marketed. I actually have the article sitting in front of me from Time Magazine talking about, this was October 30th, 2014. The title is, This Flu Shot Is Not Like the Others. And indeed, it is not like the others. This flu shot is now made on tumorigenic Madin Darby kidney cells, and it's distributed in the United States of America. So it's a Novartis flu cell vax. That is the name of it. And I've got other documents from the Department of Health and Human Services, conversations between scientists discussing how these Madin Darby kidney cells are tumorigenic, and how this vaccine will represent the first licensed vaccine in the United States to be manufactured on tumorigenic cells. Then they talk about how some of the members of this committee expressed reservations regarding the use of these tumorigenic cells, but they came to the general agreement that the approach to risk mitigation is acceptable. So they're saying basically that they know, the FDA knows, that these are tumorigenic kidney cells, and that there is a risk that any vaccine that's made on these cells could give the person who's been injected with it some form of cancer. However, they say that the risk is very small. And my problem with it is that cancers don't grow the day that you're injected with a vaccine. And we just don't do long-term studies on vaccines. So we're really never going to have the answer to this question. But, you know, it's the better part of wisdom to say you don't want to be injected with a vaccine that's been grown on a tumorigenic dog kidney cell line. Wouldn't you think?
Well, yeah. Now, when you use the word tumorigenic, you mean that this strain grows tumors, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, I didn't make the name up. The FDA talks about this. FDA documents state that that I have it right in front of me from the FDA.gov documents, introducing tumorigenic cell lines for vaccine development. Tumorigenic cells may form tumors if transferred to a recipient. I mean, this is what these documents say. So tumorigenic means that that these cells have turned into tumor cells and that they have the potential, if they go into another person, to cause tumors.
And Dr. Humphreys, just to clarify, they have used this continuous line or this tumorigenic line. They've used this in a flu vaccine. Do you know of any other ways they've used it?
I believe that it was initially started for animal vaccines. And animal vaccines are really so much worse than human vaccines because there's the assumption that animals don't live as long, and so we don't have to have the purity level that we have to have with human vaccines. So, you know, your dog, your cat, your horse are always going to be getting vaccines that have much lower standards in the production process than human vaccines. But as far as I know right now, as far as the only human vaccines that are on the market right now is for the one that I mentioned, the flu cell vax. There will be more, though. You just follow along over the years, because once this has been accepted and if it stays on the market, this will be a common substrate for vaccines to be grown on.
Are vaccines presently contaminated with animal viruses?
Vaccine manufacturers make a point of saying that their vaccines, as far as they're able to tell, using the tests available to them, are not contaminated. But as I've said before, if something is in there which has never been identified, it's hard to test for it. For instance, Dr. Bernice Eddy, during the polio vaccine era, first knew that there was something in the polio vaccine because fluid from those vaccine cultures caused cell cultures to become abnormal. Okay, so she didn't know what it was or how to identify it. She only knew there was something wrong because the way she was researching the issue. The question is, do manufacturers use a variety of tests to try to find contaminants they don't know exist, or do they only employ the tests that are already developed to identify what is known? And there was another problem with that with the simian virus 40 that we talked about in the last show. So if you don't have the right test and you don't perform it properly, you're not going to find the problem. When you consider how a live or killed viral or bacterial vaccine is made, there are numerous stages along the way where animal tissue or fluids are used that could lend itself to contamination with what they call adventitious agents, which means viruses or bacteria that have come from the animal that was used. With the rotavirus vaccine, the vaccine manufacturers didn't find the two pig virus types that contaminated the vaccine. The person who found them was someone who was playing around with a totally new technology the vaccine manufacturers weren't using. So the question is, what else is missed in all these other vaccines? And we just don't have the answer to that.
I'm speaking with physician, researcher, and author Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Today's show, Vaccination, Enough to Make You Sick. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What does one size fits all mean in the context of vaccination?
Well, in the eyes of the CDC, one size fits all simply means that everyone should line up and be injected with all the vaccines the CDC says are needed by every single person listed in their recommendations. If you have cancer or an autoimmune disease or AIDS or a prior severe reaction to a vaccine, or if you fall into a group that has not been tested in a trial, you're still likely to be pushed into taking vaccines. If you have a chronic disease, you're even more likely to be pushed into having vaccines because you are, quote, more vulnerable, unquote. Yet they may have never been tested in people with that condition. And I've had that experience myself as a nephrologist. We know that medicines don't work the same on everyone. When I dealt with high blood pressure, there were lots of different regimens that I would have to use on different kinds of people. So there was never a one-size-fits-all protocol to treat high blood pressure. And this is true for many drugs. But with vaccines, everyone is supposed to take the same vaccine and have the same good response and no severe side effects. I mean, it's completely irrational and completely unscientific to expect that everybody that you line up to have these vaccines is going to have the same response and is going to have a good response.
Well, do they give the same amount to children that they give to adults?
There's a period of cutoff where you're no longer considered a child, and then you start you'll be given the same adult vaccines. But babies are given, you know, the same. There's no stratification for weight in a baby. You know, if you're a premature infant or you're 1 year old, you're still going to get the same dose of vaccine.
How would you describe the World Health Organization? Is the WHO primarily a global disease eradication and healthcare organization, or does it have a different mandate? What's its bottom line?
Okay. Well, I used to, you know, I would hear the words, you know, World Health Organization, and I would think, oh, you know, whatever they say, that must be really good. And that's really because I didn't know any better. And it wasn't until my nightmare began and I started having to do the research and to understand more in depth what the different organizations are that support vaccination throughout the world, that I really got more information on the World Health Organization. And what I realized is that the World Health Organization has a job to do. Everybody that's there gets paid a salary, and it's essentially a business with a business plan. Very disheartening to learn about this, but that's been evident since the mid-1990s, and the public sees the World Health Organization as knights in shining armor, just like I did, who came charging in to rescue people in distress. But the reality is that the mandate of the World Health Organization is the political extension of the business mandate of the pharmaceutical companies. Their job, under the guise of keeping everyone healthy, is to keep the wealth of the drug companies fluid so that the huge medical stock market continues to roll on without a falter. And in fact, many World Health Organization consultants are pharma executives or professors with strong pharmaceutical ties or are paid handsomely through pharmaceutical companies. So there's no way around that. You have a built-in conflict of interest in the World Health Organization. And if you listen to my video, Honesty Versus Policy, I do go into some detail about that. I provide references as well. And you can guarantee that if there was ever developed a vaccine or a drug which guaranteed that no one would ever get sick from anything or get cancer or any autoimmune disease ever again, the World Health Organization would probably not want it to be heard of, because not only would everyone in the World Health Organization be out of work for that, the most lucrative sector of the stock market would be disemboweled in a week. So what would the world do with millions of out-of-work doctors, drug representatives, pharmaceutical factory workers? You know, the out-of-work doctors can't all become accident and trauma experts, which is one field which will probably always be needed. And what would all the researchers in academia do if the cure for their particular disease was found? You know, I remember in my residency when, you know, the field of AIDS specialty was really blossoming, and I thought to myself, what would happen if we had a cure for AIDS? You know, what would all these doctors who are now specializing in AIDS medicine, what would all the money that's coming through the pharmaceutical company? And it just kind of hit me between the eyes. There are other instances of this in history, but here I was in the middle of a growing new field of medicine. And I just feel like there's really not a strong drive to cure AIDS. And I think the same is true of these infectious diseases. To really, you know, go into Africa, for instance, and get people to be able to thrive and live healthfully and not need vaccines, that would make the World Health Organization redundant in that sense. It would make the pharmaceutical companies irrelevant. So I don't see how that's going to happen very easily.
You have spoken about a black market in used needles in Africa. How dangerous is this practice? How widespread? And what role do World Health Organization vaccination programs play in this black market?
Wow. I mean, it sounds pretty dangerous, doesn't it? It really sounds quite eerie. The black market in used needles is hardly ever talked about today. But 20 to 30 years ago, before information was easily accessed through the internet, it was an inside topic of huge discussion in the World Health Organization, who published papers on the topic, which I have. Once that information became known, the World Health Organization became a lot more circumspect about what they said and how they said it, because it made the extended program for immunization look really, really bad. The World Health Organization was only willing to talk about the problem and not do much about the problem. There's an organization called SafePoint Trust that you can find online that details some of the problems on their website. And I have one paper where the World Health Organization actually asks, whom should be responsible for the problem with unsafe injections? Well, it's the World Health Organization that brings in these needles to these countries. So why are they not responsible for their proper disposal? Why is SafePoint Trust having to pick up the pieces? So when I'm talking about black market needles, what we're talking about is that this extended program in immunization comes in, they do this job, they vaccinate the masses, they train people, locals, to do the vaccines, and then they walk away. And so all those syringes and all those needles that are left over, if they're not incinerated or somehow crunched up and disposed of properly, they're sold. And look, in these countries, people will sell anything to be able to survive. So the black market for needles was a booming market. And the problem didn't just extend to black market needles. Reusable needles were still being used in the 1980s and 1990s, and many a vaccine trial in Africa actually never made it to print because the participants were infected, for instance, with HIV through reused needles and died of that. So those studies often didn't follow through to the end. But that's not the only issue with needles. Any doctor or nurse is aware that just sticking a needle into someone can cause a huge problem. Ask any medical professional if it's possible to perform 1 million insulin, vitamin B12, or even saline injections without an injury. Serious adverse reactions from injections happen all the time, and medical error in general is a much larger problem than most people realize. So, you know, you can put that needle where it shouldn't go, and you can cause huge damage. And there are notifiable rates of damage in normal American hospital practice where the rate of damage is really high. There have been serious problems with needles having manufacturing issues, like in Europe, like glue resin in the barrel that gets injected into people. And even though whistleblowers in the manufacturing company tried to do something, the problem was denied and the needles were not recalled. So there are other issues too, like shrink wrap particles that have been found in vials of vaccine. And that's been reported not that long ago. Ground glass in vials of pharmaceutical production. So in 2011, actually, there was a serious problem of dozens of children exposed to all sorts of potential diseases because they were reusing flu vaccine syringes in the United States of America. So the CDC is well aware of unsafe injection practices, even in the United States of America. You know, when I was researching this, I came across things that you know, I just wanted to ignore. They're just so horrifying. I mean, there's a document that was put out in 1996 called State of the World's Vaccine and Immunization. And on page 167, these are not little documents, on page 167, I'm just going to read you a quote. It says, a survey carried out for UNICEF in Eastern Europe in 1992 to 93 revealed that almost 50% of health centers were giving unsafe injections and or using vaccine of doubtful potency. The study also revealed that children, especially orphans, were being subjected to an excessive number of injections in addition to immunization, an average of 115 injections in all during their first year. One orphan had been given over 500 injections. Okay, this is a World Health Organization document. This isn't, you know, something that I just found on some, you know, anti-vax blog site. You know, you can find these World Health Organization documents that just tell you how many cases of diseases are propagated by unsafe injections. In the World Health Organization has one, they've reported 260,000 cases of HIV and AIDS every year, 21 million hepatitis B infections, 2 million hepatitis C infections from unsafe injections. So, you know, this is not only a problem in America, it's a problem worldwide, and it couldn't happen if those syringes weren't brought into certain parts of the world and left there.
What is your view of mandatory vaccination? You have said that we live in a culture of compliance.
Yes. Mandatory vaccination means abolishing any hope of informed consent, right? So you can rip up your right to think, to choose, and to act as you wish with regard to the medical system. This mentality is already enshrined in concrete when it comes to treatment of children with cancer drugs against parents' wishes. We see this happen all the time. Even a parent who doesn't want an unwarranted antibiotic or even a fever-reducing agent is often treated like a criminal by the medical system. Mandatory vaccination is the logical product of a legalistic, paternalistic mindset which says that everyone who doesn't think like the conditioned lemmings should be forced to comply. If they won't, they should either be put under house arrest, publicly shamed, or hung, drawn, and quartered. It's taking on the same sorts of dimension as the Spanish Inquisition. Who would be surprised if the government instituted some sort of system whereby pro-vaccine parents would now rat on parents who didn't vaccinate for a financial reward? I wouldn't be surprised about that. It signals a total failure on the part of the medical profession to first acknowledge that as a system, they cause more annual deaths and disabilities than even the worst infectious diseases ever do, and that people should have the right to decide whether to engage in that system or not. That shouldn't just apply to vaccines. It should apply across the board. So in my opinion, compulsion and mandatory vaccination is one step away from slavery.
Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Today's show has been Vaccination, Enough to Make You Sick. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys is a medical doctor, internist, and board-certified nephrologist, currently in private practice. She is co-author of Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. Currently, the California legislature is fast-tracking two vaccine Senate bills. Senate Bill 277 will eliminate the personal belief and religious exemptions from vaccines required for children to attend public and private school. Senate Bill 792 will require CDC-prescribed adult immunization of child care workers, with the exception of flu vaccine. Visit drsuzanne.net. That's drsuzanne.net. And visit dissolvingillusions.com. That's dissolvingillusions.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Visit gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list to receive our newsletter. Guns and Butter Online now includes a new website, an active Twitter feed, show archives, and a blog. Follow us at G&B Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And a new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. In December 2009, economist Richard Wolff gave a lecture at Brown University. He gave the talk the provocative title, Capitalism Hits the Fan. Just recently, I downloaded and watched it on video. The talk was 2 hours long and brilliant and very useful, and Wolff is a very fine speaker. This week and next, we'll broadcast major portions of the talk. Wolff explains the economic pickle the United States is currently in, the extent of the problem, what the various causes are, what the government is doing about the problem, and what could and should be done, short-term and long-term. So the suspense doesn't get unbearable, I will summarize. It's a big, big problem. Wall Street and the bankers are far from the only culprits. The problem is much bigger than that. The problem will last a long, long time, and there are no quick fixes. Some practical steps could help, just as they helped in the previous Great Depression of the 1930s. For instance, having the government create jobs repairing our infrastructure is such a no-brainer, you'd think that even Congress could figure that step out. A real fix, though, will require major changes in the way that business enterprises are structured and operate. In today's selection, Wolff looks at some causes of our pickle, those causes that especially involve us working stiffs in the 99%, including productivity, pay, working hours, workforce growth, and consumer debt. They are all interrelated. Next week, we'll focus more on business management, the banks, investors, and other 1% types, plus some concrete suggestions for action. For now, shining the spotlight on the 99%, explaining what hit us and why, here is Professor Richard Wolff.
So we're dealing with a very profound crisis, comparable, as almost everyone admits, to the Great Depression. Not as bad yet, but who knows? How did we get into this? What does it mean? Here we need to do a little history. But I think you'll see when I'm done that it pays to do a little history. We begin with the good news, if you like. An absolutely remarkable thing about the United States that perhaps you've never thought about in this way. From shortly after our emergence as an independent country, shortly after our revolution, we start this date, 1820, and the only reason we start there is that the statistics, which aren't good for 1820, are absolutely ridiculous for any time before then. Okay, so we start with 1820. From 1820 to 1970, 150 years, long time, the following sentence is true. The average level of wages, real wages, what you actually got for an hour's worth of work, rose every decade for 150 years. There's probably no capitalist country in the world that can boast a record like that. It's absolutely stunning and unusual. Even in the Great Depression, real wages went up, because even though people's money wages went down, prices fell even more. So you ended up being able to buy more, even though you had fewer dollars in your pocket at the end, because the prices fell. A real wage simply is a measure of how many goods and services you can actually buy. It adjusts your money wage for the prices you have to pay. So for 150 years, Americans got higher wages. What did this mean? It meant that Americans began to believe, and you know that how deeply that is in our political language, that we lived in a really blessed place. God, if you believe in that, really must like us. Something magical was true about America. You came here, you worked hard, and amazing, you got more. You could imagine to live in your own home. You could even dream at one point of sending your children to college, to have a car all your own, to wear nice clothes. It was amazing. Every family thought that it would live better than the generation before, and the next generation better still. Parents got into the habit of offering their children to provide them with the education and the support that would make them have a better life. And the irony here in the United States, and the marvel, was it was true. Millions of people, the ancestors of most of us in this room, if we're Americans, came to the United States hoping to cash in on this operation, willing to work hard, expecting that their life here would reward them with a higher standard of living than they would have gotten if they'd stayed where they came from, and mostly they were right. And it becomes part of the American culture and the American imagination. This is the place where if you work hard, you get more pay. Yeah, the work may not be pleasant, the work may be difficult, but the reward is at the mall. You'll earn more money and you'll buy more stuff. Try to imagine with me what it would mean to a population that for 150 years internalizes that image, that hope, that expectation, if it were suddenly to stop being true. And I ask you to imagine that because that's what happened. In the 1970s, the rising real wage of the United States came to an end, and it has never resumed. The real wage of the American worker today, the average amount of goods and services you can buy with an hour of your labor, is no greater today than it was in 1978. You may be working harder, you may be working longer, you may be working more efficiently because you're working with a computer and all these other things. And indeed you are. You're delivering many more goods and services per hour of your work to your employer. He's very happy about it. But he doesn't pay you one iota more. This is an astonishing change, a sea change, a dramatic alteration in one's circumstance. It's all the more powerful in our country because it's unspoken. Because in the 1970s or 80s or 90s or to this day, nobody talks about this. No one confronts it. No one asks, why did this happen? What do we do about it? Instead, as good Americans, we pretend it isn't there. We imagine that if it's going on, well, it's just about me and my job and my circumstance rather than a social process. And we imagine that if it's not a social problem, just my particular problem, then I can solve it. And how am I going to solve it? How did the American working class solve the problem? Two things they did, starting in the 1970s and right up until this crisis. And those two things are part of why this crisis happens, which is why I'm going to tell you about them now. The first thing Americans did is conclude, okay, I'm not getting any more wages per hour. I know what, I'll do more hours. Smart move. And not only me, the adult male in the household, but my wife, she's going to go out. She may have been at home, she may have been a housewife, no more of that. She has to go out because we have to sustain the family standard of living rising. And the old people have to come out of retirement and take at least a part-time job, and the teenager ought to do something on Saturdays at least, don't you think? Here's a statistic to think about. The average number of hours worked per year by an American right now, average, is 20% more than the average number of hours worked by a Swedish, French, German, or Italian worker. Think about it. For every 5 hours you work, for every 6 hours you work, they only work five or something like that. Some of you go to Europe and you enjoy lovely dinners with wine in an alfresco setting in some Italian town. And you say to yourself when the dinner is over, these people know how to live. And you imagine that it's a matter of their culture. They just love grapes. It isn't got much to do with culture. What they have is time. They don't work like we do. They have time for long dinners. We are the country that invented fast food. And now you know why. It's a necessity. We don't have time to sit down. We need between jobs to run by one of those takeout windows and yell something at a disconsolate teenager who yells something back and hands you something you shouldn't put in your body in any case. And so Americans went to work, most importantly the women. In 1970, 40% of American women worked outside the home for money. Today, double, 80%. An absolutely fundamental change. Those women had to do that. They may have thought of it as women's liberation, and it certainly had those dimensions. They wanted to help the family. The point, in fact, is if the family was going to continue to consume, to give its children what it had promised, to live the American dream, since husband wasn't going to get any more wages ever again, she had to go out. But when the wife goes out, all kinds of things change. Women in America, housewomen, household women, held together the emotional life of our society. They did the emotional work. They provided the solace. When that woman has to go out and do 8 hours of work and get dressed and do the travel to the job and back home, she can't do it anymore. She may not face that fact, but she can't. Starting in the 1970s, the United States became the country with the highest rate of divorce. The relationships couldn't survive. We have 6% of the population of the world and consume over half the psychotropic drugs, the antidepressants, the tranquil. What's going on? Are we crazy people? I don't think so. I think we are under extraordinary pressure. We work the longest hours on the face of the earth. We do more hours per average worker than the Japanese. That's saying something. And our families are stressed, deeply stressed, as anyone who has studied this situation knows. Our behavior has changed under the pressure of this extra work. And one way to describe it to you is to mention a book some of you may know. A Harvard sociologist named Robert Putnam wrote a famous book with a funny title, Bowling Alone, title of the book. And here's what he does. He studies Americans' participation in anything other than making their life hang together. Bowling leagues used to absorb millions of Americans, no more. Trade unions used to be centers of collective life, no more. Community organizations used to get lots of people. PTAs did too, no more. Americans turned inward in the last 30 years, but it's not some mysterious cultural phenomenon. It has to do with you're working too hard, you're stressed out of your mind, your relationships are falling apart, your intimate life is a disaster, but you don't want to see it in terms of the wages and the job, and that's what I'm going to stress. Anyway, did it at least work? Did American families enable themselves to buy more stuff in the way they had hoped to give their kids an education when they worked all the extra hours with extra members of the family doing it? And the answer is no. It turned out that when mother went out to get a job, she needed a second car, because we don't have a very good public transportation system, and she needed a second pair of clothes, and when she was too tired to cook, she bought prepared food, and that all cost a lot of money. So the extra money she made was eaten up in an awful lot of extra expenses that were unavoidable, given that she was going to go out and work. And so it didn't work. So the American people, ever resourceful, did something else which further traumatized them. To keep the consumption going, to deliver the American dream to their children, they went on a borrowing binge, the likes of which no working class in the history of the world ever undertook before. Starting in the 1970s, the American savings rate collapsed. We stopped saving money. But much worse than that, we borrowed money. We invented a new way to give everybody debts. It's called the credit card. Before the 1970s, we didn't have that. Only rich people had an American Express card. After that, we developed the American Express card for the masses. It's called Master and Visa, and you all have them. Many of you have lots of them. You collect them. You max one out, you get another one. And then you get another one. And you keep hoping that this Russian roulette will not get you. And so in 2007, we came to the end of the line for the working class. They couldn't work any more hours. They were exhausted. They were stressed beyond words. And now they were overwhelmed by having violated what their parents had told them. Save money, little boy. Hold something back, little girl, for a difficult time, for a rainy day, for special expenses, for an illness. Not only do we not save anything, but we're in hock up to our ears. Another statistic for you. When the Great Depression began in 1929, the average level of debt of an American family was about 25 to 30% of its annual income. That's what the average family owed. In 2007, the average level of debt of an American family was 125% of its annual income. There is no precedent for an economic downturn of the sort we have when it hits a population as indebted as ours is. One of the reasons nobody knows what's going to happen in this crisis is because we've never had one under these circumstances before. But by 2007, it's over. The American working class had postponed coming to terms with the end of rising wages by working itself to the bone, by stressing itself out, and by incurring a level of anxiety about an unsustainable level of debt. The Federal Reserve keeps a statistic. What proportion of your disposable income is used simply to pay your debts? Think of it this way. How much of the money you earn can't be used to buy anything because you have to give it to the lenders who you owe money to? It's now at about 17%. One out of every $6 you earn is not available for you to spend. You just have to pay it in interest and paying back your debts. Not only will Americans be unable to borrow anymore, they can't carry it, but the people who used to lend to the United States working class are not interested in doing it anymore. Some of you will have already discovered that. You're going to get nasty letters from your credit card company announcing to you that you better pay 25, 30% on your credit card, or else you're not going to have a credit card. Your choice. As always in America, freedom of choice. Okay? So the working class is exhausted. It can't carry this. It can't continue. And somewhere in the United States, in all of us, we kind of know it. Can't quite face it, can't quite say it, but we know it. The most incredible change in our cultural form of the last 15 years has been the reemergence of films in which the leading theme is a typhoon, a flood, zombies, vampire. What is this? This notion that forces we cannot control are overtaking and undermining us, that doesn't come out of nowhere. There's a population that needs to express its fears, and that's a safe way of doing it. Let me turn now, as an economist, to the other side of the coin. If the workers have been taking it on the chin, have been experiencing life the way I've just described, how has it been going for the employers? And for those of you that have been hurting under the bad news of what I've been telling you, here's your chance to feel good. For employers, the last 30 years has been the best 30 years in the history of capitalism in the United States. No contest. And the explanation is very simple. Over the whole period from 1820 to 1970, not only did workers' wages go up, but workers' productivity went up. All that means is the quantity of goods and services that 1 hour of a worker's labor produces for the employer. It went up because workers worked harder, because they were better educated, they had more machines, they had better machines, etc. So for the 150 years, from 1820 to 1970, workers' wages went up, but what they delivered to their employers kept going up, too. In a sense, it was good for everybody. The employer got more and more, and you know how capitalism works. You come at 9, you work, you go home at 5, you leave behind whatever it is you produced, because you can't take that home. If you do, the police will come. So you have to leave that there. You go home. The employer gets it. He sells it, and he keeps the money. So if you're producing more and more per hour for your employer, he's a happy man. He's got more to sell. And over the 150 years from 1820 to 1970, he got more and more from the workers, but he also gave the workers more and more. What happened after 1970 is that changed. The workers kept producing more and more for the employer. That's after all the last 30 years is when we all begin to work with computers, and computers allow us to do a lot more in an hour than we were able to do without a computer. So we keep producing more and more for the employer. Productivity rises. But the employer doesn't give us any more at all.
You do not need an advanced degree in economics, and being a professor of economics, I wouldn't advise it anyway. But you don't need it to understand that workers are producing more and more for the employer, but he's not giving them more and more, then the whole benefit of rising productivity accrues to profits. So the people who made out like bandits in the last 30 years were the employers, number one, and whoever could get a piece of the profits the employers were getting. We call those people stock owners, shareholders. People who have a piece of a company can get a piece of the profits the company earns. That's how our system works. So the people who did really well in the last 30 years were the employers and the people who own shares in the companies. They did wonderfully. They were very happy. In 1970, the United States, among all industrial advanced countries, had the most equal distribution of wealth and income. The gap between rich and poor was smaller in the United States than it was in France or Italy or Switzerland or the other countries, or Japan. Today, we are the most unequal. Why? Because the rich took off in the last 30 years. Every statistic I know, and this is agreed to by economists left, right, and center, the distribution of income and wealth in the United States has become much more unequal. It's been a wonderful time to be involved in the stock market. From 1982 to the year 2000, the stock market had a run unparalleled in its history for that many years. Extraordinary. Nothing better illustrates how the society worked than to ask the question, why did the wages stop rising in the 1970s? Given everything I've told you, look how much hangs on that. Why did that happen? There are four basic reasons. The first one was a very important technical change. I referred to it already, the computer. The computer meant that we needed a lot fewer people to do a lot of jobs. Think with me for a minute of a supermarket. Used to be that you had to have an army of people called inventory checkers. They were the people who kept track of how many boxes of Rice Krispies, how many rolls of toilet paper were being sold, and so they would know when to order more to restock the shelves. You don't do that anymore. We don't need those people. Every time you buy a roll of toilet paper, somebody runs it by a little scanning machine that registers on a computer, oh, another toilet paper, gone. And when the little dot comes to turn red, then the one person instead of 50 who stands there mesmerized by that computer screen hits a button and more toilet paper is shipped from the company. So the computer meant, and this is the important thing, much less demand for workers. The second thing that also reduced the demand for workers, the need for workers, was the decision by American corporations not only to substitute computers for workers, but the corporations also decided to move production out of the United States, big time. Workers in other parts of the world were cheaper. Modern telecommunications made it possible to coordinate with your managers all over the world as quickly as it used to be to walk down the hall and talk to your manager at the end of the corridor. And so America moved production out of the United States, massively. A little statistic again, because economists are expected to throw statistics. I don't want to do too much, but a little, just so you remember that I am an economist. 60% of the goods coming into the United States from China are produced by subsidiaries of American corporations. There's a great temptation in this country to talk about Yes, it's Chinese workers who make them. But 60% of what comes in here is produced by American subsidiaries, American companies that are employing Chinese workers in China, because they're a hell of a lot cheaper than American workers here. But if you move jobs out of the country and if you replace workers with machines, you need a lot fewer workers. And that really got going in the 1970s. But that wasn't even all of it. Not only were there fewer jobs, but there were more Americans looking for jobs. Two groups in particular. One I've already mentioned. Women. Massive numbers of women moving into the job market. They wanted to be equal with men. They wanted to have jobs outside the home. They wanted to realize their potential in all the ways that jobs outside the home can do. and many other reasons. But there were many women, millions of them, looking for work. And we also discovered that as the world becomes more unequal, the gap between rich and poor poor people from more and more poor countries think about moving here, as people have for most of the history of the country. So we had women and immigrants flooding in to look for work, just as there were fewer jobs because of technology and export of our jobs. No surprise at all that employers took advantage of this situation, didn't have to raise wages anymore. With these extra people looking for the work, they would have to take the jobs whether you pay them a rising wage or not. And the proof of the pudding is that's what happened. They didn't pay any more wages, and Americans were as desperate for work as they had ever been. The quintessential story comes to this apex. I've been telling you how Americans went on a borrowing binge. Have any of you wondered, where did the money come to lend all those Americans all that money? Who's the lender? What's the source of the money? And if you understand what I'm about to tell you, you'll understand in a nutshell the remarkable quality of our society over the last 30 years. Because the origin of the money lent to the American worker were the extraordinary profits of American business. They had made so much money because the productivity went up when the wages went down that they turned around and used the extra profits that they got by not paying higher wages to lend it to the workers instead. Think of yourself now, and some of you will enjoy this, as if you were a businessman or a businesswoman, an employer. This is as close to nirvana as business gets. Instead of paying your workers higher wages over time as they work harder and better for you, you don't. Instead of paying them more, which is what we did from 1820 to 1970, instead of that, we give them a loan, which they have to give back to us with interest. If I had a portable record machine now, I'd play the national anthem. This is stunning. The only thing more stunning than what is going on is the fact that many of your faces betray that you didn't understand this. And nothing I'm saying is difficult. Nothing I'm saying is complicated. Nothing I'm saying is not described in 1,000 statistical series produced by the United States government every day. And I'll leave it to you to wonder why you never heard this before. What does that tell you about the society in which you live?
Professor Richard Wolff, and a passage from his lecture, Capitalism Hits the Fan. Wolff brilliantly explained some of the changes in the working world that led to the current crisis. Increased productivity, decreasing jobs, growing workforce, stagnant pay, and growing debt. Come back next week for more of Wolff. Meanwhile, check out the links on newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimae non carborundum, don't mourn, organize, imagine alternatives, and ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I'm going to start the show today by sharing some information about two 9/11 events coming up on Tuesday, March 22nd and Wednesday, March 23rd. And I'll repeat this information at the end of the show, too. And then we'll continue with some powerful audio clips of two lieutenant colonels telling it like it is. You might deny the challenges that I make to the official conspiracy theory of 9/11. But I'm in really credible company with these two retired military pilots. So let's begin first with the events. On Tuesday, March 22nd, the Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group brings you Christopher Bolin, journalist and author of the book Solving 9/11. It will be held at the Elmwood Community Center in West Hartford at 6:30 p.m. It's free and open to the public. Christopher Bolin has been on a speaking tour of parts of the U.S., and the Connecticut 9/11 Truth Movement just recently got word that he would be in the area for a few days and quickly set up this event. And again, it's at the Elmwood Community Center, which is sort of at the corner of South Quaker Lane and New Britain Avenue. To enter the parking lot, take Burgoyne Street, which is off of South Quaker Lane, not far from New Britain Avenue. So again, that's journalist and author Christopher Bolin on March 22nd. At 6:30 p.m. And then I want to tell you about the second event coming up on Wednesday, March 23rd. As part of the Progressive Movie Night, we'll be sponsoring the film Incontrovertible. It's a new British film about 9/11, and we'll be showing that at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And again, that's Wednesday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. So two events, Tuesday, March 22nd, Christopher Bolin, sponsored by the Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group, and on Wednesday, March 23rd, the movie Incontrovertible, as part of WWUH's Progressive Movie Night. More information on these two events can be found at the website 911truthoutreach.org. And again, that's 911truthoutreach.org. On the last show, you heard the pilots for 9/11 Truth challenging the science of the official account of the planes on 9/11. Now you're going to hear the conclusion of that presentation, which is roughly 5 minutes long.
Could you get such an airplane with a 156-foot wingspan into a 208-foot target without having any time in the type aircraft?
I don't think so. And as you were saying, 510 knots according to NTSB.
That's right. Supersonic speeds. Yep. And just mid-level altitudes. Now,
to me, those kinds of numbers, I think it's impossible.
We already know that based on Egypt Air 990 as precedent, that not only does a 767 not have the capability of such speeds, but according to Egypt Air 990, such speeds also cause structural failure. But let's explore the hypothetical that an unmodified 767 can obtain such speeds intact. Again, there is a reason the manufacturer sets speed limitations. These factors include flutter, as we have seen, but other factors include control surface effectiveness, center of pressure versus center of gravity, trim characteristics, to just name a few. When aircraft exceed their design limits, control effectiveness becomes increasingly non-existent. For example, as airspeed increases, the wing generates more lift. Therefore, the pilot needs to push the nose down. Trim is used to relieve these pressures. There comes a point when the airspeed is so great that the throw on the elevator and trim are at their limits and no longer can keep the nose down, and the aircraft is now said to be out of control. The elevator and trim only move so much. Conversely, and a bit more technical, center of pressure moves aft as airspeed increases. If this center of pressure becomes too far aft, the controls may reverse, in which you cannot keep the nose up. This is known as Mach tuck, and the faster you accelerate, the more the nose wants to push down. What happens when going downhill? The aircraft wants to accelerate more. Again, the aircraft is out of control. Further control reversal comes into play. Ailerons are used to turn an aircraft. One goes up, the relative wind hits it and pushes that wing down. On the other wing, the opposite aileron is moving down to push that wing up. At excessive speeds, the down aileron grabs more air from the relative wind and actually causes more drag, pulling the aircraft in that direction, opposite the turn. The pilot wants to turn right, but the aircraft turns left. This is called control reversal, and again, the aircraft is out of control. These are just some of the basic reasons manufacturers set airspeed limitations for an airframe. Again, hypothetically speaking, even if the structure remained intact at such excessive speeds, could these hijacker pilots counter such factors? Perhaps this is just another reason why so many experienced aviation professionals are raising their red flags on the government story, and the list grows. Bottom line, it's highly unlikely the damage done to the World Trade Center and the Pentagon was caused by the reported hijackers in which their best pilot could not control a single-engine Cessna at 65 knots. Some like to argue that since the World Trade Center buildings were some of the tallest in the world, that the buildings make an easy target to hit with a commercial airliner. Navy pilots take pride in the fact that they are set apart from other pilots since they perform operations from an aircraft carrier with very small margins for error. Navy pilots know the skill it takes to hit such a target, even at landing speeds in highly maneuverable jet fighter aircraft. It is contradictory to suggest that the World Trade Center is so large as an excuse for hijacker pilot ability while at the same time taking pride in some of our best pilots who use almost the same size target to tout their stick ability. Combine that with the added controllability factors at high speeds and dynamic pressures, it is absurd to think these hijacker pilots who couldn't control a 172 at 65 knots could easily hit their targets completely and thoroughly, especially being 3 for 3. Pilots for 9/11 Truth have now analyzed the aviation aspects for each event which occurred on 9/11. The Pentagon, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and now New York City. Thorough analysis proves what we've been told by the 9/11 Commission is a lie. It's interesting to note the reported aircraft, which have numerous videos and witnesses to the event, do not have recorded black box data available, and of the data of which is available, prove impossible speeds for airline fleet transport category aircraft. Those events for 9/11 which do not have any videos and very limited witnesses, most conflicting with the government story, do have data available, allegedly from these aircraft. Unfortunately, all data, whether from black boxes or radar, does not support the government story, or is physically impossible. It appears at every turn there are grave conflicts with the government story. Why is current foreign and domestic policy being dictated based on an investigation with a growing mountain of conflicts? Why was the 9/11 investigation underfunded and set up to fail? It's time to get to the truth. Contact your representatives and demand a thorough, independent investigation. Advise them to be on the right side of history.
And now you're going to hear two retired lieutenant colonels who are both pilots and who are also members of Military Professionals for 9/11 Truth. These audio clips are from a 2010 event. And I apologize in advance for some of the sound quality. They were taped live, and so there are some imperfections. So let's begin.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dave Gapp, and I'm a retired U.S. Air Force pilot with 31 years service in the Air Force. I just retired in late 2009 with a background in flying fighter aircraft, as well as a graduate of the Air Force's flight safety course. I'm an experienced aircraft accident investigator, as well as safety board president. We currently find ourselves involved in a nearly 9-year-long war in Afghanistan, which has a projected Department of Defense budget of $120 billion for 2011, while spending an estimated $140 billion in Afghanistan this year. We now have more U.S. troops killed in less than 2 years President Obama has been in office than the 575 troops that were killed in Afghanistan in 7 years under President Bush. Troop levels in Afghanistan have expanded from 33,000 when President Obama entered office in January 2009. We have 98,000 troops there this month. Our federal deficit will be approximately $1 trillion next year, while military spending remains nearly 50% of our U.S. federal budget. We need a way out of this mess to refocus our country's priorities on investing in education, infrastructure, and job creation. The ongoing war in Afghanistan is based on alleged involvement by agents of Al-Qaeda, of which many professional organizations have serious questions that are yet to be answered by the U.S. government. One of the many professional organizations that is proud to question the official U.S. government's version of the events of September 11, 2001, is being announced today. Military Officers for 9/11 Truth. It now has over 300 founding members and can be found at militaryofficersfor911truth.org. In my professional opinion as an aviator, I have the following concerns, which I would like to entitle Aviation Improbabilities. Now, I'm not saying that these are impossible to happen as individual occurrences, but that it is highly improbable that they would all occur in a series to have the outcome as professed by the U.S. government. The improbability of all 8 airline pilots voluntarily giving up control of their aircraft to individuals stating that they have box cutters and have or will kill passengers. This is not established protocol to give up control of the aircraft and responsibility of safety for all your passengers and crew. The improbability of all 8 airline pilots being killed without a deliberate, violent flight control reaction that would upend any cockpit invasion. The improbability of all 8 airline pilots not entering the hijack or emergency code into the transponders, alerting air traffic control of a serious problem. The improbability, if the above events occurred, that the marginally trained hijackers would be able to operate the navigational systems necessary and fly to specific points in airspace using instrument flight rules. The improbability of maneuvering the airliners above 400 knots airspeed, which is considered high speed, and precisely striking comparatively small World Trade Center 1 and 2. Professional pilots and simulators have about a 1 in 3 chance of accomplishing this maneuver. Improbability of maneuvering American Airlines Flight 77 from 35,000 feet descending to hit the Pentagon, as stated by the U.S. government in an analysis of the flight data recorder. Specifically, a 330-degree turn from 7,000 feet descending at a controlled airspeed of 290 to 300 knots airspeed to precisely strike the Pentagon at ground level by a minimally trained, unqualified hijacker. As a military fighter pilot, I have questions as to why numerous air defense systems were not utilized that day, including intercept aircraft that had plenty of time from 8:14 a.m. when Boston Center air traffic controllers realized something was wrong with American Airlines Flight 11 after it did not respond to authorization to change flight levels. There were 3 air defense exercises ongoing on September 11th, and their command posts and chain of commands were fully staffed. Otis Air Force Base, Massachusetts, had Air National Guard F-15 fighter interceptors nearby, which were airborne too late at 8:53. Flight 11 hit the North Tower at 8:45 a.m., followed by Flight 175 hitting the South Tower at 9:03 a.m. Many other bases, including Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington, D.C., and Langley Air Force Base, Virginia, have fighters on alert or available. Why did none of them launch in time to intercept Flight 77, as it did not strike until 9:37 a.m.? Finally, as an experienced aircraft investigator, I have serious questions regarding several of the crash sites. Again, it is improbable that of the 8 black boxes, in reality, a bright orange flight data recorder and a bright orange cockpit voice recorder on each of the aircraft, only the flight data recorder from Flight 77 into the Pentagon, and both recorders from Flight 93 in Pennsylvania were recovered. With over 1.5 million man-hours of time sorting through debris at the Fresh-Kill site in New Jersey, it is improbable that we don't have more aircraft evidence of what actually occurred in each of the unfortunate airliners that day. Thank you again for your time and consideration of these facts.
The next audio clip you'll hear is from Lieutenant Colonel Bob Bowman, who has been critical of the official conspiracy theory of 9/11 since very early on. He passed away a few years ago from cancer.
And now we'll bring to the microphone Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bowman.
Thank you. As a pilot, I concur with Colonel Gapp's analysis of the gross improbabilities in the official conspiracy theory. And as an old interceptor pilot, I share his puzzlement over the lack of interceptors that fateful morning. As a career military officer, I'd like to concentrate on the enormous harm the official 9/11 conspiracy theory has done to our military establishment and to the people in it. Using 9/11 as the excuse the multinational corporations and bankers have used our brave young troops as cannon fodder in their corporate wars of aggression. They have systematically taken away our constitutional rights, including those of our military personnel. The entire war on terror is phony, and it would be even if you believed the ludicrous official conspiracy theory about 9/11. Both wars were planned before 9/11. The war of aggression against Afghanistan was in retaliation for the Taliban refusing UNICAL rights to build a gas pipeline across Afghanistan to get trillions of dollars worth of gas from the Caspian Sea to their tankers in the ocean. The military leadership knew it had nothing to do with the Taliban harboring Osama bin Laden. The Taliban had offered to give us Osama for trial, but the Bush administration ignored the offer for two reasons. One, they had no evidence against Osama, and according to the FBI, still don't. And two, the war had already been planned in detail to secure that gas pipeline. The war against Iraq was outlined in the PNAC document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, published before George W. Bush even became president. Its purpose was to provide a military staging base from which to control the entire Middle East and its tens of trillions of dollars worth of oil and gas. Now, the authors of that document admitted in it that the American people would never go along with their plans unless there was a catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, unquote. Well, 9/11 provided that event. Yet they were unable to tie Iraq to 9/11, no matter how hard they tried. So they came up with a new excuse, WMD, weapons of mass destruction. It is here that we in the military saw through their charade. They had us mass 150,000 troops in one small area in Kuwait, awaiting the start of shock and awe. If our military commanders had even the slightest thought that Saddam Hussein might have had even one WMD, they never would have deployed their troops so that they could be wiped out in a single attack with one WMD. The truth is that our government knew there were no WMD in Iraq. Our people in the military were put in a horrible position. Either sacrifice their career and their freedom by refusing orders, or knowingly participate in a war of aggression against their oath of office and the Nuremberg principles enshrined in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So we have two corporate wars of aggression, wars in which we are making the same mistake as in my war, Vietnam. We are fighting the people who live there. What has been the result? About 5,500 of our finest have died. The lives of 40,000 of our injured soldiers will never be the same. Tens of thousands of our young men and women have severe psychological problems because of what they have seen and what they have done. Hundreds of thousands have been poisoned by depleted uranium and will suffer lives of pain and disability and will father thousands of children with severe birth defects. Our military services are depleted and demoralized. The VA system is underfunded and overwhelmed. The National Guard and reserves have been subjected to tour after tour, disrupting lives for even the lucky ones who return unscathed. Jobs have been lost. Homes have been foreclosed. Marriages have been destroyed. Children have been estranged. And for what? We have alienated our friends around the world and made new enemies. We have created thousands of new recruits for Osama bin Laden, whether he's alive or dead. And we have further endangered the American people, and all because of 9/11. You know, there's massive evidence of a cover-up with respect to 9/11 itself. I've spoken with both Governor Kaine and Congressman Hamilton, the co-chairs of the commission, and they both say that there are outright falsehoods in the final report. Never mind all the omissions. The report over which they had no control. It was written in the Bush White House by Philip Zelikow. Now, when you combine this with the confiscation of videotapes, audio tapes, black boxes, and other evidence by the FBI, it is clear that regardless of who was responsible for 9/11, the subsequent cover-up was itself a conspiracy involving elements of the Bush White House and the intelligence establishment. To prevent further 9/11s, we must get to the truth about all those involved in the last one. You know, the American people have never been told who was really responsible for 9/11. Dedicated researchers, like some we've heard today, have proven that it could not have happened the way the Bush administration said it did. Hijacked airliners do not fly around for an hour and 40 minutes without being intercepted, unless our air defense system was deliberately sabotaged. And 19 Arabs with box cutters couldn't have done that. Indestructible black boxes, and by the way, they're not really black, they're bright orange, but never mind. Indestructible black boxes do not evaporate in the same fire from which an unharmed passport floats to the street below. Airliner, all of whose parts carry identifying numbers, do not crash without leaving a shred of evidence as to what they were. You know, the truth about 9/11 is that after 9 years, we still don't know the truth about 9/11, and we should, and so should the families of victims. And let us always remember, the victims of 9/11 include not just the roughly 3,000 people who lost their lives that day, but the 5,500 military personnel who have lost their lives in the Afghan and Iraqi wars, as well as the hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghan and Iraqi civilians. All of these victims and their families cry out for a new independent investigation of 9/11. Only when the official myth is exposed and the truth told will the wars and occupations end. The creation of new victims stopped and our military returned to its constitutional task of protecting our borders and our people, not the financial interests of multinational corporations. This one change in military mission, eliminating the mission of protecting the global financial interests of multinational corporations, will allow us to greatly enhance our national security and reduce the defense budget by 80%. But it's not going to happen until people learn the truth about 9/11. Only then will people understand that our security is not enhanced by sending our working class youth around the world to kill the sons and daughters of working people in other countries. Only then will people understand that our security is not enhanced by sending our children to the Middle East to kill Arabs so the oil companies can profit from selling the oil under their sand. No more battleship Maines, no more Pearl Harbors, no more Gulfs of Tonkin, no more incubators in Kuwait, no more 9/11s, no more false flag attacks, no more lies. As a 100% disabled combat veteran, I say the best thing our government can do for us is to quit making more of us. But how do we get our government to support what's left of our troops by bringing them home while they're still alive? How do we achieve a new constitutional foreign and military policy? We, the people, must reassert our sovereignty, and the key to doing that is 9/11 truth. We must expose, indict, convict, and incarcerate the liars, the murderers, and the traitors, and then replace them with patriots devoted to the truth and to service to the people. Seek the truth, and the truth shall make us free. Thank you very much.
And again, you were just listening to two powerful speeches given by Lieutenant Colonel David Gap and Lieutenant Colonel Bob Bowman, given in 2010. Now, in 2016, 60% of our national budget goes to the military, and we are trillions of dollars in debt due to the 9/11 wars and some outright theft, like the $2.3 trillion from the Pentagon, announced missing on September 10, 2001, by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. And now I'm going to read you a few paragraphs from a long article by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts called "There Is No Freedom Without Truth. Conspiracies Are Real." And here goes. The charge conspiracy theory is used to prevent investigation. 9/11 was not investigated. Indeed, as many experts have pointed out, there was a conscious effort to remove and destroy the evidence before it could be investigated. The 9/11 families had to lobby and protest for a solid year before the Bush regime consented to a totally controlled 9/11 commission. The Boston Marathon bombing was not investigated. A scripted story was issued and repeated by the media. The San Bernardino shootings were not investigated. Again, a pre-scripted story took the place of investigation. The success of false flag attacks in the U.S. led to their use in the U.K. and France. The Charlie Hebdo affair was not investigated, and the official explanation makes no sense. The story has been closed with all the loose ends dangling. For example, why did a French police official investigating the crime allegedly commit suicide in his police office in the early hours of the morning, and why was his family denied the autopsy report? What happened to this disappeared story? Why did the police finger a third participant in the attack as the, quote, getaway driver who had an ironclad alibi? If the police were so totally wrong about this member of the gang, how do we know they are right about the two men they shot to death? How come alleged perpetrators of, quote, terrorist attacks are always killed before they can talk? How come the only story we ever get is what the government says? How can people be so gullible after the Gulf of Tonkin or Operation Gladio, etc.? He closes out the article to say, "Dear Western peoples, if you wish to be able to walk down the streets of your cities without being accosted by police, demanded to present identity papers, searched, detained indefinitely, or assassinated without due process of law, if you wish to be able to express your opinion about, quote, your government and its use of your tax payments, if you wish to be able to discuss current affairs or your personal affairs without being recorded by the NSA or the equivalent in your own country or by both, if you wish to be able to act on your moral conscience and to protest the violence the West applies to Muslims and others unfavored by powerful Western interests, if you wish to live in the freedom that was achieved in the West after centuries of struggle, wake up. Find time from less meaningful pursuits to become aware of what is being stolen from you. It is late in the game. If you do not stand up for truth, you will have no freedom, as there is no freedom without truth." And Dr. Paul Craig Roberts was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy and Associate Editor of the Wall Street Journal, as well as author of several books. And now I'll announce again the two upcoming events. On Tuesday, March 22nd, the Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group brings you Christopher Bolin, journalist and author of the book Solving 9/11. It will be held at the Elmwood Community Center in West Hartford at 6:30 p.m. It's free and open to the public. Christopher Bolin has been on a speaking tour of parts of the U.S., and the Connecticut 9/11 Truth Movement just recently got word that he would be in the area for a few days and quickly set up this event. And again, it's at the Elmwood Community Center on March 22nd at 6:30 p.m. It's at the Elmwood Community Center, which is sort of at the corner of South Quaker Lane and New Britain Avenue. To enter the parking lot, take Burgoyne Street, which is off of South Quaker Lane, not far from New Britain Avenue. So again, that's journalist and author Christopher Bolin. And then I want to tell you about the second event coming up on Wednesday, March 23rd. As part of the Progressive Movie Night, we'll be sponsoring the film Incontrovertible. It's a new British film about 9/11, and we'll be showing that at 7 p.m. in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford. And again, that is free, and please park in Lot B. It's closest to the auditorium. And again, that's Wednesday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. So two events, Tuesday, March 22nd, Christopher Bolin, sponsored by the Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group, And on Wednesday, March 23rd, the movie Incontrovertible, as part of WWUH's Progressive Movie Night. More information on these two events can be found at the website 911truthoutreach.org. And again, that's 911truthoutreach.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Kanesh.
New Jersey's powerful grassroots People's Organization for Progress decides that it's time to take Bernie Sanders' candidacy for president to heart. The People's Organization for Progress has rarely departed from a long-standing policy of not supporting candidates for office and engaged in a rigorous debate and careful consideration about reaching its position on how to relate to the 2016 presidential election.
POP's chairman Larry Hamm acknowledged the struggle of Bernie Sanders to date to build support in urban communities, specifically with Black and Latino voters. It did come up and it will continue to come up, but the fact remains that many of his basic positions will benefit Black people, said the activist. Single-payer health care, raising the minimum wage, affordable college, rebuilding crumbling infrastructure. Although those specific platform planks may not be addressed specifically to African Americans, Black people know they will benefit from those things.
POP's chairman, Larry Hamm, said, "While we should be deeply concerned by how Republican candidates like Donald Trump and Ted Cruz have taken the Republican Party so far to the right, we on the left should be just as active as they are and should give serious consideration to how the Sanders campaign could possibly take the Democratic Party from the center-right to the left." Larry Hamm, chairperson of one of the country's most important grassroots organizations, thanks for taking the time to join our WBAI listeners.
It's good to be here with you.
Larry, take us through the discussion, because certainly there are comrades are free to disagree, but there are a number of groups that are immersed in Black Lives Matters-oriented issues fundamentally who have decided to stay away from a specific endorsement, and those who have still been enormously reticent about Bernie Sanders. What was the nature of the discussion, and why did POP come to a different conclusion?
Okay, I will take you through that discussion, but could I give a shout out real quick?
Oh, of course.
Since this is the Community and Labor Report, I want to give a shout out to the AFT of New Jersey and thank them for giving the People's Organization for Progress their Friend of Labor Award at their state conference.
Wow.
This Saturday, as a matter of fact, and I forgot to mention this to you, maybe so much is going on, but this happened Saturday. They had their state conference down in Atlantic City, and they asked me to come down and receive this award. This award was not to me. It was to the People's Organization for Progress, particularly because of the role that we played in the struggle at Kane University. There was a struggle at Kane University around the general question of various manifestations of institutional racism and also anti-labor policies, but specifically around getting the president of the college, Farahi, to resign. And we were active in that struggle and supported the various demonstrations that the folks there were organizing, including the local AFT on the AFT local on the campus. And also they recognized POP for our participation in the struggle to return local control to the school district in Newark, which has been now under state control for almost 20 years. And as you can see from reading the headlines in the newspapers, things have not been any better under state control. So I just want to thank the AFT for that consideration they gave us this weekend.
Oh, I think we should thank POP, because POP is one of the groups that really has melded the issues of class, issues of the working class, with the issues of, in fact, Black Lives Matter. And you do it superbly. And that's why we think it's so important, the decision that your organization has made in this context, and what the pending kind of historic poll possibilities are for POP
yes.
in its decision to endorse Bernie Sanders as yes, Democratic Party candidate.
Yes, our discussion of the Sanders campaign actually started last summer. In fact, you all were familiar with the Million People's March that we had against police brutality in Newark, New Jersey, a very successful mobilization, probably the largest anti-police brutality rally in the history of the city of Newark. And I want to thank you for the support you gave us on your show. That helped to bring people out. Discussion around the Sanders campaign actually started around late June. We had heard that Sanders might be running for president, but it really didn't become clear to us till that summer. And the discussion started immediately about the Sanders campaign. I mean, there were some people who were for it. There were some people who felt we shouldn't get involved, because many of us, including myself, we understand that there's a establishment bias within the Democratic Party. It's clear that they want Hillary Clinton. And, you know, POP has its origins in the Jackson campaign of not its origins. We were actually formed in 1983, but we began to grow as an organization as a result of our participation in the Jesse Jackson campaigns for president in 1984 and 1988. So we had kind of been down the electoral road. And, you know, we know how not only the economy is rigged, but the political system is rigged against candidates who even put forward what some might consider mild reform. And people felt that they would end up ambushing Sanders at the convention, which will be this summer in Philadelphia, just like they ambushed Jesse Jackson in the convention in Atlanta in 1988. In 84, he had accrued some delegates, but not enough to really pose a serious threat to the establishment candidates at that time. But in 88, the Jackson campaign did pose a serious threat to the Democratic Party. As a matter of fact, I think they actually began organizing that Democratic Leadership Council after the Jackson campaign, 1988, because they felt the Democratic Party had a leftward drift in it, and they wanted to stop that from happening. And that's when they put that Democratic Leadership Council, of which Bill Clinton was a leader, a founding member, to keep the party from moving to the left, and in fact, even move it to the right in order to appeal to the so-called Reagan Democrats. They felt the Democratic Party was losing some of its base to the Republican Party. But so we began to have this discussion. And as a matter of fact, we had made a decision sometime in the late summer to have some discussion about the presidential campaign or on our agenda at every meeting. And POP meets every Thursday at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. Now, in the 33-year history of the People's Organization for Progress, we've only endorsed to date, if we include Senator Sanders, three candidates. And one was Barack Obama when he ran in 2004. The second one was Ross Baraka when he ran for mayor in Newark in 2014. So up until the Sanders campaign, we had only endorsed two candidates. And people come to us for endorsements all the time. But our experience with electoral politics has kind of made us, we invite candidates to come speak to us. We even have candidate forums. You know, we want people to know who's running for office and what their platforms are. But generally, our attitude has been let people make up their minds for themselves, because we found from earlier years of experience with POP that electoral politics, you know, it's like fire. You got to know how to handle it, because it can cause splits and divisions in your own ranks. I mean, for many offices, you know, you have people from the same communities, from the same class, you know, from the same race and class background, who should all be struggling against a common foe. They end up struggling against each other. And sometimes these things, I've actually seen struggles break out in churches, because people, same people belong, same church, they end up running against each other in an election, and it could get very contentious. But we began to listen to Bernie Sanders and what he was saying. And some of the issues that he was raising, you know, were the same issues we, in fact, have in the core demand of the People's Organization for Progress. Since the founding of our organization in 1983, one of our core demands has been for universal health care. One of our core demands was for free college education. One of our core demands was increasing the minimum wage. At that time, 1983, we just said increase minimum wage, and today we support the $15 minimum wage. And also Sanders' anti-corporate, anti-capitalist stance. You know, the Dr. Martin Luther King said we need a radical redistribution of wealth and power in the United States. We need a radical restructuring of our socioeconomic system. And Bernie Sanders is out talking about the growing inequality, how none of the wealth has trickled down and all the wealth has trickled up, the rich are getting richer, and the masses of people are being pushed down into poverty. So these were things that attracted us to the Sanders campaigns. Now, were there some problems? Yes. I mean, especially initially around the issue of reparation, you know, because the People's Organization for Progress, that's one of our, that, in fact, that's our number one core demand from our founding, was for reparations for the descendants of those who were enslaved in this country. And initially Sanders said that he was not in support of reparations, but my understanding is that he's moved back from that position. But nonetheless, you know, it was problematic for us, you know, and so on and so forth. But when we looked at the overall picture, we said, look, there's going to be a primary election. There are only going to be two candidates on the ballot. The primary in New Jersey now, for folks in New York, your primary, I believe, is April 19th. For us, our primary is June the 7th. And they're going to be two choices. Now, we could either stand on the sidelines and not participate and let the masses of our people, because in the black community, the overwhelming majority of voters who do come out and participate, you know, they're black and they're members of the Democratic Party. So we could either let them be herded by the toward the establishment candidate, or we could, you know, try to push them, you know, in a more progressive direction toward a candidate whose platform was more like our own and more in the interests of working and poor people in this country. And that's basically why we decided, you know, after much struggle, I mean, I'm giving you like the collapsed, you know, in time collapsed version of what happened. This is a struggle that went on for 6 months, because we did not officially endorse Bernie Sanders until mid-January of this year, January of 2016, because we couldn't do it and we didn't want to do it unless the overwhelming majority of our members were united behind it. We weren't going to endorse Sanders with no 51-49 split in the organization. That's a formula for disaster. We had to take our time, struggle with people, try to convince them of the need to do this. And when we had what some people might consider a super majority, a three-fourths majority, that's when we decided we were ready. to make that endorsement.
Larry, let me ask you this. I remember, and I believe it was Minister Farrakhan who once said that, frankly, they select and we're then told to elect, that there really is a complete disenfranchisement and lack of democracy in the electoral process, particularly on the presidential level. So that there are those who have taken that to heart and said, well, what we're advocating is that people write in a pro-reparation stance in general and just use their ballot that way. Why participate, and what do we do, or what does a group like POP do with the reality that there's been a historic betrayal of the African-American community subsequent to vying for its vote?
Right. First of all, let me say I very much respect the position of that other organizations have on this. Some of them range from non-participation to I recently heard that one of the organizations that we have very close ties with said, well, write your own name in or write in on the ballot, vote for reparations. We generally respect that. I mean, I, as much as anyone else, understand why people would be alienated from this corrupt political system, from this political system that clearly is under oligarchic control, under the control of the ruling class in this country. But at the same time, we don't see this referendum, this election, as simply a contest between two individuals. It's also a referendum on what we stand for, and it gives us the opportunity to make manifest, to make clear to the rest of the society what people really want. I mean, even if Sanders doesn't get elected, the fact that he could get close to 50, because I believe by the time he gets to the convention, even if he doesn't get the nomination, which he probably won't, even if he ends up, let's just say he ends up with a few more delegates than a few more of the elected delegates than Hillary Clinton. They're going to use the superdelegates to thwart any attempt to get the nomination. They're going to throw as many of the superdelegates as they can get, because now some of the superdelegates are in a bind. They committed to Hillary Clinton early on, and since that time, many of their states have in fact gone for Sanders. So I think what we're going to see, you may see some of these superdelegates are going to have to bend to the pressure of their own constituencies. How can you vote for the candidate that the majority of Democrats in your state did not support? But nonetheless, they're going to try to use this trapdoor of the superdelegates. I mean, consider this. There are over 600 superdelegates. You only need 2,300 and some odd delegates to get the nomination. So they're going to try to use that in Hillary Clinton's favor. But nonetheless, it will be clear. What do the American people want? They don't want any more income inequality. They want the rich to be taxed at their fair share, at a much higher rate than they're being taxed now. They want public colleges to be free. They want the $15 minimum wage. They want universal health care. See, this is not just a contest between two individuals. This is also a referendum on which direction the country should go in. Should it go in the direction of proto-fascism, authoritarianism, and what could only be considered as feudal inequality, the way the society is skewed in America today? Our class structure almost looks like that of medieval Europe, with a handful of very rich people at the top of the pyramid and almost everybody else at the bottom now. I mean, many of us who thought of ourselves as being middle class, including myself, we lost our home in the last economic crisis. The greatest loss of black wealth since emancipation took place in this last economic crisis, because the majority of black folks' wealth was tied up in their home, and hundreds of thousands of black people lost their homes. Right now in the county that I live in, Essex County. Newark is located in Essex County. Essex County has the highest rate of foreclosure in the state. In today's Star Ledger, there are 30 pages of sheriff sales on foreclosed homes. And this is the situation every week. And this is a situation we see across America. So we have to look at this in a broader context than just simply this is a vote between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. No, we're actually voting to show people what we want in this society. And that's the way I think most of us in pop see it right now.
And, of course, there's no question that pop will continue to do what it needs to do, which we all understand is organizing, because it ultimately is the will of the people that has to be effectuated for a democratic society.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, our strategy, we're not just organizers. Like I said, we have not had a lot of participation in the election system. We do engage in voter registration every year, but we don't really go in to do too much campaigning. But just today is Monday, for the past 11 weeks, the People's Organization for Progress has been engaged in what we call Justice Mondays. And, of course, we modeled that on the Moral Mondays of Brother William Barber.
We have about 45 seconds left, Larry.
That's right. Well, I just say, yes, we're going to keep the heat on in the street as we tell people to go to the ballot box, stay in the street, mobilize people to vote November the 8th in the general election, and continue to fight after. In fact, the most important day will be November 9th after the election is over, because the struggle will continue.
We have been speaking to what we believe is one of the most diehard, the most important, intrepid, and smart organizations who has really taken to heart and organized and created a sustainable organization around the issues of Black Lives Matter. Always a pleasure to speak with Larry Hamm, chairperson of the People's Organization for Progress.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on, my daughter? Which side are you on, boy? Which side are you on?
See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffins, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The U.S. government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listen and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been woken. I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple and Oaxaca, and we hold the machetes. I rock hard like palace feeding children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip hop, for the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor. I'm on the side of the workers, the teachers, and lunch ladies. On the streets with brown mommies, raising our brown babies. I'm with youth organizers, cleaning up the Bronx River. I'm like Jaime Escalante when I stand and deliver. I'm with Evo Morales, man, he running Bolivia. Distribution of the land so we can all live bigger. I'm with Hugo and Fidel, Grandmaster Remedy Mel. I'm with the Panthers up in Queens, justice for Sean Bell. I'm with Camacho Negron, I'm with Ojeda Rios. Freedom for Oscar López, time to get in the field. I'm with Abu Jamal, I'm with Asada Shakur. I'm with the compas in the market, he getting a penny more.
Now, former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich weighs in support of Bernie Sanders.
Six responses to Bernie skeptics. Number one, says the skeptic, he'd never beat Trump or Cruz in a general election. Well, that's wrong. According to the latest polls, Bernie is the strongest Democratic candidate in the general election, defeating both Donald Trump and Ted Cruz in hypothetical matchups. The latest Real Clear Politics averages of all polls shows Bernie beating Trump by a larger margin than Hillary Clinton beats Trump, and Bernie beating Cruz while Hillary loses to Cruz. Number two, he couldn't get any of his ideas implemented because Congress would reject them. Well, if both houses of Congress remain in Republican hands, no Democrat will be able to get much legislation through Congress and will have to rely instead on executive orders and regulations. But there's a higher likelihood of kicking Republicans out if Bernie's political revolution continues to surge around America, bringing with it millions of young people and other voters and keeping them politically engaged. Number three, says the skeptic, America would never elect a socialist. Please. America's most successful and beloved government programs are social insurance, Social Security, and Medicare. I mean, a highway is a shared social expenditure, as is the military and public parks and schools. The real problem is we now have excessive socialism for the rich, bailouts of Wall Street, subsidies for big ag and big pharma, monopolization by cable companies and giant health insurers, giant tax-deductible CEO pay packages, all of which Bernie wants to end or prevent. Number four, says the skeptic, his single-payer health care proposal would cost so much it would require raising taxes on the middle class. This is a duplicitous argument. Single-payer systems in other rich nations have proven cheaper than private for-profit health insurers because they don't spend huge sums on advertising and marketing, executive pay, and billing. So even if the Sanders single-payer plan did require some higher taxes, Americans would still come out way ahead because they'd save far more than that on health insurance. Number five. His plan for paying for college with a tax on Wall Street trades would mean colleges would be run by government rules. Baloney. Three-quarters of college students today already attend public universities, financed largely by state governments, and they're not run by government rules. The real problem is too many young people still can't afford a college education. The move toward free public higher education that began years ago and extended into the 1960s, came to an abrupt stop in the 1980s. We must restart it. Number six, he's too old. Well, that's untrue. He's in great health. Have you seen how agile and forceful he is as he campaigns around the country? These days, 70s are the new 60s. He's younger than four of the nine Supreme Court justices. In any event, the issue is not age. It's having the right values. Franklin D. Roosevelt was paralyzed. John F. Kennedy had Addison's and Crohn's diseases. But they were great presidents because they fought adamantly for social and economic justice.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I think the NBA should move the All-Star game from Charlotte.
Kansas is going to pay students $2,500 to report transgender kids in the bathroom.
I think it's a good deal.
Probably the broadest of these laws that have yet been passed.
Visit Mississippi. We're even worse than North Carolina.
Don't lose hope. I was fired for being gay, but look at me now.
I think Prism Comics is very important in terms of providing a safe haven and also a place for LGBT fans and readers to come within a mainstream convention like this. I think it's invaluable.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Columbia's High Court comes out for marriage equality. A U.S. bias bill's boom sparks backlashes against bigotry, and queer geeks gather at WonderCon. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending April 9th, 2016. Gay and lesbian couples in Colombia are making wedding plans because justices of the nation's constitutional court have ruled for marriage equality by a vote of 6-3. The decision issued by the nation's highest court on April 7th was thought to take effect immediately. But there was a sense that perhaps government bureaucrats needed a day or two to catch up to the new reality before they could start issuing marriage licenses to same-gender couples. The same court in an earlier case in 2011 ordered Colombia's Congress to create a law establishing civil marriage equality by June 20, 2013. Lawmakers failed to meet that deadline. That meant that same-gender couples could technically get legally married, but they were required to seek out a notary or judge to formally solemnize their commitment, and many judges and notaries refused to serve them. Four of those couples filed the lawsuit that concluded this week the decision determined that no judge or notary could refuse to marry a same-gender couple. Justice Alberto Rojas summed up the court's majority decision, writing that all human beings have the fundamental right to be married with no discrimination. President Juan Manuel Santos's government has supported civil marriage equality, bucking opposition from the powerful Roman Catholic Church and the country's independent inspector general. Congresswoman Angelica Lozano proclaimed that, "Today we've won our constitutional rights. Now we need to fight on the streets and inside people's homes."
Never one to pass up the chance to rain on LGBT parades or civil marriages, the latest thoughts issued by Pope Francis this week included an absolute certainty that the Roman Catholic Church would never bless same-gender unions. In a 256-page document on family life, released on April 8th and called Amoris Laetitia, or Joy of Love, the Vatican underscores the Church's definition of marriage as only between a man and woman. As for proposals to place unions between homosexual persons on the same level as marriage, the document says, there are absolutely no grounds for considering homosexual unions to be in any way similar or even remotely analogous to God's plan for marriage and family. The document essentially summarizes conclusions reached at recent synods on the church and family life, where proposals to liberalize Roman Catholic teachings were quietly offered but quickly rejected. Transgender people are also in the Pope's crosshairs. It is one thing to be understanding of human weakness and the complexities of life, and another to accept ideologies that attempt to sunder what are inseparable aspects of reality, he writes. Let us not fall into the sin of trying to replace the Creator. Creation is prior to us and must be received as a gift.
But the Vatican has refused the gift of an openly gay ambassador from France. President François Hollande originally proposed his head of protocol, Laurent Stefanini, for the Holy See position last year, but the Vatican steadfastly refused to confirm the appointment. The French Catholic newspaper La Croix cited an unnamed source who said the Vatican considered it a provocation that France's socialist government, which in 2013 opened civil marriage to same-gender couples, had proposed an openly gay man for the post. The fact that Stefanini is a practicing Roman Catholic, was supported by the Archbishop of Paris, and has neither married nor entered into a civil union, apparently had no influence on the Vatican's Christian charity. France officially gave up on that appointment this week and named Stefanini ambassador to UNESCO, the Paris-based cultural agency of the United Nations. The country's Vatican ambassadorship will remain unfilled until at least next year.
The district court's ruling errs in so many respects that it is hard to know where to begin. Thus began the first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decision on April 7th, confirming equal civil marriage rights in Puerto Rico. District Court Judge Juan Perez-Gimenez claimed that the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 marriage equality ruling didn't apply to Puerto Rico because it's a U.S. territory, not a state. The First Circuit decision was not subtle. "For present purposes, we need not gild the lily," it said. "The district court both misconstrued the Supreme Court ruling and directly contradicted our mandate. The appeals court issued an order requiring the district court to strike down the civil marriage ban in Puerto Rico that Judge Perez-Gimenez had upheld, and then ordered the clerk to assign that task to a different judge."
Some 200 bills targeting the civil rights of sexual and gender minorities have been introduced in dozens of U.S. states. A few have already passed. The consensus view seems to be that those efforts are in response to last year's U.S. Supreme Court civil marriage equality ruling. In North Carolina, Republican Governor Pat McCrory signed HB 2, a bill overturning an LGBT civil rights ordinance in the city of Charlotte and banning other local governments from enacting similar protections. But the only thing defenders of HB 2 want to talk about is the provision that requires transgender people to use the gender-segregated facilities in public buildings and school campuses that match the gender on their birth certificate. The law is having the opposite effect of what lawmakers intended, however. Bearded trans men are now required by North Carolina law to use women's restrooms, and curvaceous trans women must now pee in public men's rooms, where possibly predatory heterosexual men could be less than welcoming.
Rock and roll icon Bruce Springsteen canceled a concert scheduled for April 10th in Greensboro, North Carolina, to protest HB 2. Apologizing to his fans there, he said in a statement that tickets would be refunded at point of purchase. "Some things are more important than a rock show," he said, "and this fight against prejudice and bigotry is one of them." E Street bandmate guitarist Steve Van Zandt told the Associated Press that escalating state legislative attacks on LGBT people are like an evil virus spreading across the country.
A burgeoning number of business conglomerates are not only criticizing North Carolina, they're abandoning it. Just this week, PayPal canceled plans for an expansion in Charlotte. Lionsgate is among the production companies to cancel filming in the Tar Heel State. Well over 100 corporate giants, ranging from Apple to Marriott Hotels to the NBA, have condemned the legislation. Officials in major U.S. cities and more states are banning official travel to North Carolina, and federal agencies are reviewing funding to the state in view of its apparent violations of the U.S. Constitution.
Throwing caution to the wind, Phil Bryant, the Republican governor of Mississippi, signed a so-called religious freedom bill this week that critics call the most sweeping anti-LGBT legislation in the country to date. It allows businesses, individuals, and religiously affiliated organizations to deny service to LGBT people, single mothers, and others they don't like based on the provider's sincerely held religious belief or moral convictions. It also directly targets transgender residents, essentially stipulating that one's gender assigned at birth is immutable and will be the only gender recognized by the state. Officials in several big cities and states that have already banned travel to North Carolina are now also banning official travel to Mississippi. Businesses are similarly condemning, and in some cases fleeing, the hospitality state in growing numbers. And, as with North Carolina, federal officials are examining aid to Mississippi because of its clearly discriminatory laws.
Meanwhile, the latest in a slew of anti-queer bills in Kansas would make it impossible for transgender people to legally change their name or change their gender on legal documents. Tennessee lawmakers are considering a bill allowing counselors and mental health professionals to refuse to serve a patient based on sincerely held religious beliefs. They also advanced a proposal this week to bar trans students from using the restrooms or locker rooms that correspond to their gender identity.
But finally, Pennsylvania's Democratic Governor, Tom Wolf, may have had the best response so far to the spate of anti-LGBT legislation in the United States. He announced an executive order on April 7th that bans discrimination against LGBT state employees. A media statement noted that Governor Wolf has made clear that this startling trend in other states will not find success in Pennsylvania. He also used his bully pulpit to call on lawmakers to finally pass a statewide law banning workplace bias based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Pennsylvania is the only state in the Northeast without one. Pointedly criticizing his fellow governors in North Carolina and Mississippi, Wolf told Pittsburgh radio station WESA that, "We want to be known as a welcoming state. We want to be known as a place that's open for everybody."
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 9th, 2016, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Beaupre.
Conquering heroes of the queer comic book crowd cavort around a cosmic convention. Later in the program. In late March, lawmakers in the state of North Carolina overturned an LGBT-inclusive civil rights ordinance in the city of Charlotte and banned any of the city, county, or local municipality from protecting its LGBT citizens. The state has suffered significant economic losses in tourism and support from major businesses. Iconic NBA All-Star and sports commentator Charles Barkley added his voice to a growing chorus denouncing the new law this week during an interview with CNN's Frederico Whitfield.
You've also made some strong comments about, say, Indianapolis last year.
So as a black
what
man,
many people call the anti-gay
legislation,
and now it's North Carolina that's under the microscope.
Yes. And I think the NBA should move the All-Star game from there next year. You know, as a black person, I'm against any form of discrimination against whites, Hispanics, gays, lesbians, however you want to phrase it. It's my job with a position of power that I'm in, being able to be on television. I'm supposed to stand up for the people who can't stand up for themselves. So I think the NBA should move the All-Star game from Charlotte. And we can figure out, I know Atlanta wants to host it, but they should move it out of Charlotte.
Step to the left, now step to the right. Put your knees together and squeeze them tight. Keep your arms moving side to side. Try to hold it in till it's time to ride. Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in. I gotta go. Knock, knock, let me in. Knock, knock, let me in. I gotta go.
Most of the world, however, certainly most of the Western world, must be scratching its collective head over those crazy Yanks' obsession with toilets. All the media talk about the North Carolina law has focused on one provision that requires trans people to use gender-segregated public facilities, such as bathrooms and locker rooms, based on what's on their birth certificate, not the gender with which they identify. To be fair, that media attention has been fiercely driven by defensive state officials, led by Governor Pat McCrory, who claimed that the law protects women and children from bathroom boogeymen. Comedy Central's The Daily Show with Trevor Noah led a chorus of derision from late-night talk shows.
Across the country, restrooms have become a battleground when it comes to gender identity.
North Carolina requires people to use public bathrooms that correspond with the gender on their birth certificate.
Wait, what? This is my thing. This is the problem with hatred. It's never really well thought out because now you expect people to carry their birth certificates to every public restroom in your state. But in Kansas, they were like, nah, we're going to take this to the next level.
A bill making its way through the Kansas House and Senate would force transgender students to use bathrooms of the sex they were born into.
Schools would have to pay $2,500 to students who encounter a transgender student in the bathroom.
The $2,500 bounty on the heads of transgender children.
Are you me? Kansas is going to pay students $2,500 to report transgender kids in the bathroom. And once again, hatred not well thought out. Because Kansas high schoolers, you know what you guys should do? Just make friends with the transgender kid. And then every time you go to the bathroom together, you're making $12.50 a pop. Yeah, that's what you guys are doing. You're both making money and you don't have any bigotry. $12.50 each, that's enough money to get you the f*** out of Kansas, Dorothy.
And the good news is that people are standing up and speaking out against this, especially America's most important people, corporations.
PayPal saying that it is going to cancel its plans to bring 400 jobs to North Carolina.
Coca-Cola and Disney oppose the measure.
Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and Apple's Tim Cook.
The NBA might move next year's All-Star Game out of Charlotte.
The governors of three states have told non-essential state employees not to travel to North Carolina on official business.
A travel advisory.
Damn.
North Carolina, you realize they're treating you like you've got Ebola. And it makes sense. If you think about it, bigotry is a lot like Ebola. Only difference is the comes out of your mouth instead of your ass.
Not to be outdone, lawmakers in the Republican-dominated legislature in Mississippi this week, gleefully joined by GOP Governor Phil Bryant, added religious protections to the state's existing licenses to discriminate.
Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant signed a law allowing both public and private businesses to refuse service to gay couples based on the employer's religious beliefs. And according to the governor, it reinforces the freedom to exercise their religion as stated in the First Amendment.
If a baker or photographer says, my deeply held religious views is that I cannot participate in a religious ceremony like a wedding, the state cannot discriminate against someone because of their religious views.
It says government officials can refuse to provide services to same-sex couples. So the protection applies to government employees and private businesses. And that makes it probably the broadest of these laws that have yet been passed.
You'd think that holier-than-thous in Mississippi would have learned something from backlashes to laws rolling back LGBT rights in Arizona, Indiana, and most recently in North Carolina. Phil Bryant and his buddies are not unexpectedly getting pummeled by big business, human rights advocates, officials in other states, and the federal government. On the heels of Bruce Springsteen canceling his concert in North Carolina to protest that state's anti-LGBT law, Canadian rocker Bryan Adams canceled the show scheduled this week in Biloxi to protest Mississippi's new law. Growing boycotts of the hospitality state are sure to have an impact on its already impoverished economy. And the rebellion continues.
Governor, can you tell us why you signed the bill?
Sure, because I think it's a good bill. I think it protects the religious freedom of people who have deeply held religious beliefs. And so did the legislature and so did the majority of the people of the state of Mississippi. So we signed it into law.
We're Mississippi. We're proud of our southern values, magnolia trees, and hot days. Now, thanks to Governor Bryant, we have an oppressive law to match our oppressive heat. Here, you can march to the beat of your own drum as long as that beat harkens back to 1888. Visit one of our soul food restaurants and swallow your sense of humanity. Toast to being the state with the third highest teen pregnancy rate. Come dance your heart out without the fear of a gay man or lesbian showing you up. Paddle your way through semantics that justify discrimination. Explore nature with your nuclear family while explaining to your kids why being different is bad and why sex is scary. Soak up the fun in our national chain restaurants and stores before they pack up and leave. Walk amongst mansions previously inhabited by slave owners and now inhabited by bigots. Explore our vast collection of books before we burn them all. And fish in the quiet solitude of knowing that you've been left behind by history. Visit Mississippi. We're even worse than North Carolina.
Trailblazing Out TV talk show host Ellen DeGeneres, who's from the area, had a few choice words for Mississippi and some encouraging words for people who feel trapped in bigot town.
If you don't know, the governor of the state signed a religious freedom bill, which might sound good because the word freedom is in it. But here's what it means. Under the law, if you say for religious reasons, you can deny gay people marriage, adoption, and foster care services, fire or refuse to employ them, and decline to rent or sell them property. That is the definition of discrimination. It is also something that the Supreme Court already ruled on when they made marriage a right for everyone. Everyone. Sometimes I think it's easier to explain things if you break it down. So imagine this. Okay, so two cupcakes walk into a flower shop, and they want to buy a dozen roses. But the florist doesn't believe in selling flowers to cupcakes because they don't have any money. But gay people do, so sell them damn flowers. If you're in Mississippi or North Carolina or anywhere and you're saddened by the fact that people are judging you based on who you love, don't lose hope. I was fired for being gay, and I know what it feels like. I lost everything. But look at me now. I could buy that governor's mansion, flip it, and make a $7 million profit. I mean, look, there's already so much inequality in the world. Women's rights, gender pay gap, racism. I think we need to remember that we are more similar than we are different. And we all want the same things. Love, acceptance, kindness, and I want one of those new Teslas. And so I advocate for less hate and more love. Less tearing apart and more coming together. Less sitting and more dancing. I'm Ellen DeGeneres, and you're listening to This Way Out. That was without cue cards, people. And I say to myself, it's wonderful, wonderful. Oh, so wonderful, my love.
When Comic-Con International opened the doors to this year's WonderCon, it took entertainment correspondent Steve Fry no time at all to find the queer center of gravity among the gathering geeks.
It's Friday, March 25th, the opening day of WonderCon at the Los Angeles Convention Center. I'm Steve Fry, reporting for the convention floor at the Prism Comics booth. For over a decade, Prism Comics has been the leading organization for queer-friendly comic books, writers, artists, and educators.
My name is Alex Wolfson. I have two books. I have Artifice, which is a science fiction story, and The Young Protectors, which is an ongoing superhero story. Both are meant to be really strong genre stories first, but with heroes who just happen to like guys.
What's the reaction been to The Young Protectors?
Well, so far, very positive. I feel very lucky in that just last year I was able to quit my day job, and this is how I support myself. It's with my comics, and The Young Protectors in particular.
How important is Prism Comics as a group?
Well, I think Prism Comics is very important. I never would have gone to any conventions without Prism Comics. They were the ones who introduced me to conventions. In terms of nurturing new creators, and also in terms of providing a safe haven and also a place for LGBT fans and readers to come within a mainstream convention like this, I think it's invaluable.
How important are queer comics?
I think that the stories we see in the world kind of give us a ceiling and a floor for what we can expect in our own lives. And I think in the past, when you had LGBT characters, they were considered expendable at best. And at worst, they were considered sort of marked for death and misery. I think it's very important to have comics that are out there that actually can show that LGBT people of all stripes can be heroes so that they can see themselves as heroes.
What is the intersection of the geek culture and the gay culture?
In some ways, both have been marginalized unfairly, obviously. I mean, that's an easy one to go for. But I think you also can be defined by what you like. And I think that would be another intersection that you would see there. And so I think what you find is a lot of LGBT people who are also serious geeks. I think that it's probably a greater proportion of LGBT people who are into speculative fiction and into kind of geeky things than perhaps in the mainstream population.
Where can we go for more information about your work?
Well, you can go to my website, which is AMW Comics. You can also read each of the individual comics for free online. So to read this, the science fiction story, that's artificecomic.com, artificecomic.com, and youngprotectors.com. That's youngprotectors.com.
I'm David Reddish, and I wrote the Sex, Drugs, and Superheroes series. So the books are Sex, Drugs, and Superheroes, and the sequel, Conquest of the Planet of the Geeks. And they are about the Comic-Con subculture. They're set in San Diego at Comic-Con, and it's all about the mayhem and the people that go there.
Is there an intersection of gay and geek?
It's a big, multi-lane intersection, actually. There are so many parallels between superheroes and the way gay people have to live their lives in so many ways. You know, the gay-geek thing, it's the same thing to me. They're sort of inseparable in my mind.
Where can we get more information about your work?
You can go to sexdrugsuperheroes.com.
Hello, my name is Elizabeth Beyer, and I have an autobiographical series called Bisexual Trials and Errors, which centers around dating men and women and the perils of having huge crushes. I also have a book called I Like Your Headband, a First Crush Story, And as the title suggests, it's about my first crush ever. And I have one book called We Belong, Stories and Portraits from the Lexington Club, which is about a bar in San Francisco that is unfortunately gone now.
What's the biggest misunderstanding about the bi community?
I think the biggest misunderstandings come when a bisexual person happens to marry or become in a long-term relationship with a person of the opposite gender. People think that their queerness is sucked away from them. But in fact, that person is still just as queer as before. And it's silly because, like, the whole point is bisexual, like, choices, options. They think that to be queer looks like a certain thing. But to be queer can look like so many things. It's about how you carry yourself in the world, who you like, who you have loved in the past. It's not just about who you're with now. So yes, bisexuals should have pride no matter who it is that they're with.
How will we find out more information about you and your books?
My website is elizabethdrewyou.com. So Elizabeth, DREWYOU.com.
Hi, I'm John Macy, and I'm on the board of Prism Comics, and I handle the Queer Press grant. I'm also the author of Telony and Camille and Fearful Hunter.
How's it going here at WonderCon?
Well, this is a really exciting time for us because we're announcing the grant winner. We're also getting ready to launch the LGBTQAIU Comics Creators from Prism Comics. And those are all the people from the Prism Comics Queer Press grant. And I get to announce who won the grant this year. And right now, I'm the only person who knows. So I'm just busting up. And it's just something that is very important. Not just the money we get. We get $2,000 for their printing costs. But it's just the validation. And right now, there's some micro grants out there. But there's no real grant or award for queer comics. The Lambda Literary Award has opened up to graphic novels, but there's something really heartwarming when you see somebody who's a new cartoonist, somebody who's like asexual, who's not getting represented out there, and they get the grant, and it's just you just see them proud of themselves.
How do less fabulous folk react to the Prism Comics booth?
Well, a couple years ago, people used to come to the booth, they look, oh, comics, and then they start realizing it's all lesbian and gay comics, and then they would get this kind of frightened, dead man stare, and they would run off. But I have noticed that since queer marriage passed, there's people who come up, and they're just like, oh, well, I'm not gay or lesbian, but I'm curious about all this because I've heard about it. And they're not scared. There's something about, because of this ruling from the Supreme Court, people are more comfortable. It's okay. We don't have to be afraid of us anymore. And now they tell us stories about their queer grandchildren. It's really sweet. It's been very nice.
Is there a website for more information on Prism and on you?
There's prismcomics.org, and I'm at Northwest Press.
Reporting from the Prism Comics booth on the floor of WonderCon 2016 in Los Angeles, this is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Wenzel Jones, and Steve Pride contributed program material, Teen Titans and Johnny Mathis performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listeners, supporters, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org. And a big hi-de-ho to Chiampa Radio, Tampa, Florida, CFXU, Antigonish, Nova Scotia, KRZA, Alamosa, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Sudan against the grain. Agriculture in the Soviet Union had some colossal disasters, not the least of which was the near destruction of the Aral Sea, and some significant successes as well. But most of the analysis of that experience has been seen through a Cold War lens. I'm Sasha Lilly. Historian Jenny Lee Smith joins me to talk about Soviet agriculture. She argues that it compares decently to other mid-century industrialized agricultural systems, including that of the United States, which of course may not be saying much. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. If we hear anything about the history of Soviet agriculture, it's a pretty bleak picture. A story of unchecked environmental destruction, enormous waste and inefficiency, and the oppression of the people involved in it. The underlying message is often that attempts to organize agriculture differently is a utopian dream doomed to failure. In Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963, which is published by Yale University Press, historian of technology and the environment, Jenny Lee Smith, takes a fresh look at the experience of Soviet agriculture, which spanned 10 time zones and numerous climates and ecosystems. She examines both its successes and dismal failures and situates it next to other 20th century industrialized agriculture systems. She teaches in the School of History and Sociology at Georgia Institute of Technology, and she joins me now. Jenny, if we hear anything about the history of Soviet agriculture, it's of unmitigated failure. Where does that idea, that reigning assessment, come from?
Well, it's not wholly inaccurate. There were a lot of problems with the Soviet system, and there were a lot of failures that Soviet agriculture experienced in the roughly 75 years it was sort of up and running. But it's no small feat to have an agricultural system working for 75 years. I mean, every year that you bring in a harvest is sort of a miniature triumph. And the Soviet Union was able to do that successfully more often than not for most of the time that the Soviets were in power. I think that a lot of the impression of failure comes from, you know, it's a remnant of the Cold War, basically. It's just the time period when all of this was unfolding was a time period when the United States felt a lot of competition with the Soviet Union. This is the era of the space race. And I think that competition really altered the way that the United States looked at Soviet agriculture. They were looking at problems. They were looking for problems rather than looking to see what kinds of solutions the Soviet Union had come up with or creative workarounds and things like that. So I think that's really part of that impression is a leftover from the Cold War period.
And one of the things that you argue in your book is that there are actually many more commonalities between the United States and the Soviet experience in terms of industrialized agriculture than one might assume. But their origins, the origins of the Soviet agriculture experience, is of course very different than that of the United States. And so I wonder if you could tell us what the Russian Empire looked like on the eve of the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something I write about, that the Soviet Union really comes from rural origins. So as the Bolsheviks are coming to power in 1917 and then during the Civil War period, this is a country that's 80 or 90% peasants, really, people living on the land who make their living as farmers. Many of them are very poor. Many of them are illiterate. One of the statistics I have in my book is that there's more cattle and oxen registered in Russia than there are people in most communities. And Russia is not a place that's known for having a huge supply of cows and oxen. So that's saying something about the kind of rural, the rural life that people are living here. And the Bolsheviks really had to contend with that. They had to, this was what they built their industrialized society out of, was this kind of agrarian, somewhat, I don't really want to use the word backward, but it definitely wasn't, a cutting edge society the way that perhaps the wealthier countries in Western Europe were in the 1917 period.
How did the Bolsheviks think of the countryside and think of the role of agriculture in their project?
Well, they didn't think about it very hard at the beginning. I think when the Bolsheviks came into power, they were very idealistic, and their first focus was sort of on workers and the proletarians who were behind the movement with them. But, you know, agriculture is how people get food. And during the Civil War, especially 1921 and 1922, these were very hungry years in the new Soviet Union. And so the Bolsheviks had to start thinking about agriculture pretty much right away, and how they were going to sort of persuade, you know, the average new Soviet peasant to get on board with their programs and their projects. So they started thinking about it right away. They got, you know, they tried several different tactics for persuading these people that they should be producing food for the Bolsheviks. They, you know, for most of the 1920s, they left farmers alone. Taxes were pretty low, and farmers were allowed to sell their surplus on the open market. It didn't look much like what we understand communism to be today. And then Stalin comes into power, and the 1930s are a different story. He's much more of a whip than a carrot guy, you could say. He's really Stalin is interested in forcing the Soviet. I still think the right word is peasantry. Well into the 1930s, but he's really interested in forcing the Soviet peasantry to go along with state building projects, and that's when you see collectivization. That's when you see a really massive famine, which is essentially a second civil war that Stalin launches on the countryside in the early 1930s to sort of get these parts of the country on board with the, you know, as you said, the urban Bolsheviks' original vision of communism.
Well, you start your study of Soviet agriculture in 1930, so that's the year after Stalin's forced collectivization. And I wonder if you could just explain to us what collectivization entailed.
Sure. So collectivization was several different things in different parts of the country. It happened on paper first. The Bolsheviks were really sort of famous for making bold declarations and turning them into laws, and then sort of distorting the statistics and the newspaper reporting and things like that to make it seem like everything had already happened. You know, any law that they had enacted, it was already working perfectly. And so you see this happening with collectivization, with orders to collectivize the farms. Collectivizing the farms, I think before I started this study, I had a really different idea of what it meant to collectivize a farm. I guess I thought it was a more hands-on process where somehow the Soviet state went into the countryside and sort of created these great big, you know, maybe 10,000 acre farms and put in big barns and huge new state-run facilities. That's not really what happened at all. Collectivization, you know, first it happens on paper, and then the Soviets, you know, they do go into villages and get people in the villages to sort of sign up for the collective farm, often sort of by hook or by crook. They hold a big community meeting, and then people are sort of strongly urged, strongly encouraged, maybe because there's a Bolshevik official in the back of the room with a large gun to sign up on the collective farm. But then very little else really happens. People go back to their houses. There aren't any new facilities that are built. Maybe the Bolsheviks will take over, you know, the former church. This is a period when they're beginning to really crack down on religion, and they'll turn a village church into sort of a collective farm headquarters where they'll house a couple of bookkeepers or something like that. But the look and the feel of the countryside doesn't change much in this period. The Bolsheviks are really eager to get the countryside mechanized with machines like tractors and combine harvesters. They're really eager to have peasants combine their fields into great big wheat fields instead of little tiny plots of land. But all of those things really come later. It's a slow process. It doesn't really happen overnight, except on paper, basically.
And how do those peasants react to these changes, especially as with time the process moves ahead?
Well, different people reacted in different ways. Some peasants were really interested in being part of the collectivization program. They were in a minority, but I would say especially somewhat wealthier communities that were close to major metropolitan areas like Moscow or like Leningrad, present-day St. Petersburg. These were people who were often kind of on board with this whole process. People in the farther away places, what you might want to call the hinterlands of the Soviet Union, places in Ukraine or places that were pretty distant from these cities, were much more reluctant, especially in communities that had previously sort of had some kind of history of resistance or problems with the state or who had gone reluctantly with the Bolsheviks and Soviet power rather than remaining independent at the time of the Civil War. These were people who really wanted to be left alone by the state, had been very grateful for that sort of breathing space that was there in the 1920s, and were not eager at all to go back to a more top-down, heavy-handed form of government, which was really what collectivization promised at this time. So it really varied, but there were definitely, if you look at a map geographically, there's sort of hotbeds of resistance, and they tend to be away from cities, and they tend to be in places like Ukraine, places that have a really strong ethnic identity or nationalist identity that at this time was still very separate from the Soviet identity.
You argue that the Soviet definition of agricultural progress and the methods that were used to achieve that progress changed over time. And I wonder if you could talk about what those ideals were in the 1930s.
Progress in the 1930s in the Soviet Union really meant tractors. There were probably some other measures, but the Soviet Union was very focused on machines and heavy industry. And it really meant bringing more machines and better machines to the fields. In my book, I write about a farm that doesn't have any tractors at all in 1930. This is a small pig farm in a village Ivanova, which is up in the north of the Soviet Union, not too far away from present day St. Petersburg, I guess. And you know, places that weren't getting tractors were really getting left behind in some ways. They were interested in participating in collective endeavors, but they, you know, they were often sort of a second tier group. The village I write about, the Soviet Union decides that they should have pigs instead, and so they hire all of these pig experts to come in, and you know, they're getting money and resources from the state to raise pigs. The state is trying hard to turn this into an industrial operation. But really, the Soviet Union is much better with machines than it is with animals. That's one of the points of my book, is really that it does a good job getting heavy machines onto farms. It doesn't do such a great job increasing the size or productivity or survival rate of animals like pigs, of agricultural animals at this time.
I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Jenny Lee Smith, author of Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. You, Jenny, were just talking about machinery and how that fitted in with the Soviets' notion of progress. How did the Soviets judge their not only their notion of success, but just their ideal about what industrialized agriculture should look like in contrast to the United States, both a rival and in some ways a model?
Well, the Soviets really idolized American agriculture. I think most of the world did, especially in the 1930s, but this remains true in the post-war period as well. Agriculture in the U.S. is a little special, in part because the United States has a really temperate climate, and we also have, you know, as Americans, we've had a lot of industrial progress happen really rapidly, especially in the realm of agriculture. In the Soviet Union, that wasn't true, and so the Soviets look to the U.S. as a model. They import tractor plans from the United States. In fact, Henry Ford actually has a contract to produce tractors in the Soviet Union in the late 1920s. They look at plans for things like pig farms, and they also import animal stock. So prize-winning pigs in the United States might get shipped over, purchased by the Soviet Union in the period just before World War II. After World War II, the United States makes much of that kind of purchasing illegal. But before the war, there's quite a bit of that going on. The Soviets are trying really hard to learn from and borrow and adopt American-style agriculture. They plan to sort of impose a socialist ideology on that agriculture, but they're really interested in, you know, they believe in the American model of success, and they want to emulate that, basically. They want to imitate that on their own soil.
Well, a huge blow to Soviet agriculture and, of course, to Soviet society in general was World War II, which was particularly devastating for the Soviet Union. How did World War II affect on the ground Soviet agriculture and then also create a kind of a break between the pre-war period and the post-war period in terms of Soviet planning and policy?
It was really a difference of night and day. One of the other things I learned in the course of this project, and you know, I think a lot of historians realize this eventually, but you just can't overstate the level of devastation that the Soviet Union experienced during World War II. It was really tremendous. I think for most, the American experience of World War II was one of a loss of thousands of soldiers, and it was, you know, tragic, but you know, in the Soviet Union, this is a loss of tens of millions of people in the war. This was especially devastating for agriculture. The Soviet Union, you know, was invaded by the German army, and it was occupied for most of the war by the German army. So these lands that the Germans took over were the most agriculturally productive parts of the Soviet Union. And so during the war, the Soviet Union was cut off from sort of its heartlands. And there was also a lot of devastation. Stalin adopted what was called a scorched earth campaign, where as people retreated in the face of the German army, they were supposed to burn not only their fields, but to destroy their machinery and their barns and things like that. So when people were moving back into places in Ukraine and southern Russia at the end of World War II, it really wasn't a matter of starting over. It was a matter of starting from nothing. There was almost nothing left to sort of build up from. This was both a blessing and a curse. People were able to start new, to build and change agriculture in some really interesting ways in the post-war period. But there were a lot of people who also chose not to go back into agriculture, to not move back to the collective farms at the end of the war, because it was just, the devastation was just too great, and it was just too hard to do that, to completely rebuild their lives.
Did that shift in any way the pre-war focus on machinery as being the ultimate focus of agriculture, since obviously following the war, so much of that had been destroyed?
Yeah, so after the war, the Soviets still really love their machines. That never really goes away. But they do get more and more interested in animals and improving animal agriculture. And this isn't just the Soviets. I mean, I trace this out in the Soviet Union, but you see this as sort of a global fixation in this Cold War period, that the United States, Great Britain, France, many countries are very interested in boosting animal production and encouraging people to eat more meat and making more meat cheaper and more available to people as a way to sort of prove their success in agriculture and their sort of level of civilization and sophistication. So this is not lost on the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is doing the same thing. They are also trying to boost productivity in animal agriculture. And so this is sort of a different focus. We go from struggling pig farms that the Soviet Union kind of gives up on in the 1930s to a real push in the 40s and 50s for improving every level of animal agriculture and you know, charting out how much more meat and milk Soviet citizens are having access to, you know, on a year-by-year basis.
And how did that influence the way that the general public, Soviet public, saw the state? Did it have a sense that if the availability of meat and dairy had increased, that they were in a society that was looking after them more than in the past, where famine was a real danger?
To some extent, yes. I think that, you know, this definition is created in part because meat has always been a marker of wealth, and people who have access to meat historically have always been the richest people, the most upper class people in a society. And one of the promises of modern society is that everyday workers can have access to those same kinds of luxuries, that those things that were once scarce are suddenly available to all. So I think that's really where it comes from, is just this historic idea that meat is, you know, the best thing out there. I think that gets exploited during the Cold War. And I think the United States really starts this competition in many ways, because the United States knows that it has a superior agricultural system. That has a lot more to do with, you know, how much of the U.S.'s agricultural system is in a temperate zone, how long their growing season is and things like that. But the U.S. knows it can kind of win this game. It's always going to look more productive. It's always going to be yielding, you know, larger cows and fatter pigs and things like that, simply because it's a warmer climate. The animals tend to be larger and thrive more in temperate zones, and they tend to struggle and be smaller in colder places. And the Soviet Union had an awful lot of cold places, so it couldn't necessarily compete on size, at least, with the United States. It certainly tried to compete in terms of scale, and it came up with some creative ways for measuring what counts as a meat product or a milk product during these years. But for the most part, it knew that it was always going to sort of be second to the United States without some creative accounting taken in place.
Jenny Smith, you write in your book, Works in Progress, that following World War II, the Soviet Union, Soviet planners shifted their approach to agriculture to focus particularly on the idea of the human control over nature. And I wonder if you could talk about something you just touched on, which is the nature, the environment, or really many environments that one found across the vast expanse of the Soviet Union. To what degree did that pose challenges that were unique to the Soviet Union, and how did that fit in with this idea of controlling nature?
The environment is not quite everything in agriculture, but it sure is a lot. And it won't surprise anyone in your audience to learn that the Soviet Union was a pretty cold place comparatively, more on scale with Canada probably than the United States. But if you look at the productivity of the Soviet Union, they're really trying to compete with the United States in terms of agricultural productivity. The Soviet Union is huge, and so it has a really varied climate. There's definitely parts of the Soviet Union, or there were parts of the Soviet Union where, you know, that are semi-tropical, that grew, you know, dates and things like that. But there is an awful lot of the Soviet Union that is tundra and steppe land and very marginal for agriculture. These are places with extremely short growing seasons. I don't think I mentioned it in the book, but there are stories about Siberian farmers. One of their jobs was actually to go and sweep the snow off of the fields before they planted their grain, just to get a couple of extra days. If they got the snow off of it, then the sun would shine down on the earth and warm it up so that the soil would unfreeze just a few days earlier, which was important for productivity in these marginal climates. So those are the kinds of climates that the Soviets are trying to deal with. They adopt a lot of different kinds of strategies to sort of try to overcome the environment during this period. And I think the important thing to remember here, I mean, hearing about the strategies is fascinating, but the important thing to remember is that they really thought they could overcome the environment, that by employing technology, by employing a huge army of agricultural workers, they would be able to sort of rise above the fact that they were in such a northern climate. They would be able to have the world's best agricultural system. So the Soviet Union was very idealistic in this, in thinking that they sort of had inherited, an empire without limits, without the same kinds of biological limits that I think maybe people today are recognizing are much less flexible than perhaps two or three generations back we assumed them to be. And again, I think that's been sort of a global and collective realization that there really are some hard and fast limits, that it's not especially profitable or worthwhile to try to get around in agriculture.
Well, one of the places that you could call it idealism or perhaps hubris comes to play in this story is around the influence of the pseudoscientific ideas of the Soviet biologist and agronomist Trofim Lysenko. I wonder if you could tell us the thrust of his ideas and then the interesting story of how they were applied in practice in Soviet agriculture.
So I think Lysenko is a little bit famous in this country. Perhaps some people have heard of him as a sort of 20th century Lamarckian. So he essentially became famous for believing in a theory of acquired characteristics. He was a plant biologist working in the 19-teens and 1920s in the new Soviet Union. And he was kind of a guy who was in the right place at the right time. So he's from very humble origins. And he was a true believer, at least at the beginning, in the Soviet system, and he really benefited by it. He sort of launched a very successful career. At some point, however, you know, he becomes quite a careerist. He's a very ambitious guy, and he begins sort of, you know, proselytizing, maybe is a good word, but spreading the word of bad science, essentially. And most of his ideas are kind of related to communism, the idea that, you know, a plant can overcome hardship, it can overcome a bad climate or an unfriendly beginning, and it can learn to thrive if the right kind of attention is paid to it. This was something that he wrote about for both plants and animals, and his theories were applied widely in the post-war period, largely because the Soviet Union really wanted to increase its productivity. In the field of plant agriculture, Lysenko's theories were really devastating. They were responsible for a number of different crop failures that have been really well documented. And I definitely don't want to take away from the idea that he was a charlatan, essentially, and that he was offering bad science as a way to sort of advance himself politically within the Soviet system. What was interesting to me and what I write about in Works in Progress is that these same ideas applied in animal agriculture actually don't represent a huge failure. A lot of his suggestions of nurturing animals when they are very young, of improving their feed so that they will grow bigger and stronger and have bigger and stronger babies, a lot of those things actually work. It turns out that if you do pay extra close attention to animals very early in life, regardless of their genetics, they do tend to have a higher survival rate. If you make sure to fatten them up before you breed them, they tend to have heavier babies when they do give birth. And so these facts actually ended up sort of making it look like Lysenko knew what he was talking about during this period. So one of the ongoing mysteries of Lysenkoism is that it didn't take people very long to figure out that Lamarckianism didn't work very well. But Lysenko was around in the Soviet Union for a really long time. He rises to power in the 1930s, but he stays in power well into the 1950s. His fall doesn't happen until Khrushchev is ousted as premier of the Soviet Union in the early 1960s. So I really think that the success he experienced with animal agriculture in changing policies to reflect sort of Lysenkoist ideals, and the fact that this was one of the first times the Soviets really did have success in improving their population rate with animals, I think this is, you know, I think you can tie these two things together, that this is one of the reasons Lysenko was around for as long as he was.
Historian of technology and the environment, Jenny Smith is my guest. We'll return with her in just a moment. Thank you. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Today we're talking about the environmental and social lessons to be learned from a mid-century industrialized agricultural system. No, not the United States, but that of the Soviet Union. I'm joined by Jenny Lee Smith. She is a historian of technology and the environment, and we're discussing her book, Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. That's published by Yale University Press. As you alluded to before the break, Khrushchev came to power in 1956. He did so following the death of Stalin in 1953. And he himself was from peasant origins, rural origins. Under his tenure, how did Soviet planning change regarding agriculture?
Well, Khrushchev really came to power wanting to make a mark in agriculture, wanting to improve productivity. And this was one of the focuses of his years in office. As you said, he was from a rural background, and unlike Stalin, he was very interested in bringing real progress and real change to the rural Soviet Union. That's not to say that he was especially effective at doing that, but he did start out with intentions to go in that direction. Khrushchev was often called a kukuruznik. He was very interested in corn. And one of the sort of ongoing jokes, I think if people know something about Khrushchev, they might know that he tries to get corn to grow in very cold parts of the Soviet Union, in Siberia and Kazakhstan. And this is true, but Khrushchev is not trying to convince Soviet citizens that they should eat corn. He's not trying to get the corn to ripen amazingly fast. What he's doing is he's raising this corn so that they can feed it to pigs and cows. This is meant to be a new fodder crop for the Soviet Union. And when you feed corn to animals, you don't need it to be ripe at all. So the fact that corn really never turns yellow on the ear as it's growing in these very cold climates is secondary. It's providing a brand new source of feed for a new generation of animals. Khrushchev and one of his ministers, Anastas Mikoyan, were both really interested in using things like feed crops and biological technologies to sort of improve the performance of animals, to make bigger animals, to have more, you know, baby piglets every year, things like that. So he was very enthusiastic about these projects. That enthusiasm was also part of his downfall. He was absolutely certain that these things were going to succeed, and when they didn't, year after year, the people around him began to lose faith in him. And one of the main reasons for him stepping down from power in, I believe it was 1963, he leaves office, is because of this loss of faith, because he sort of promised big changes in agriculture, and he's attempted to make these things happen. He has a number of different agricultural campaigns, but ultimately none of them are runaway successes. None of them deliver what he has promised they're going to deliver.
What was his Virgin Lands campaign?
So the Virgin Lands campaign was a campaign to populate and plow up big chunks of Kazakhstan and southern Siberia, the far east of the Soviet Union. And this was a campaign he implemented in the 1950s as a way to expand agriculture in the Soviet Union. And again, the reason he's interested in expanding, and specifically fields. So he wants to expand the number of fields and the acreage of grain in the Soviet Union. He wants to do this. This grain is earmarked for animals, for the most part. Most of this new land is creating feed and fodder crops for animals. It's not very successful. The first few years are successful, but it has and other scholars have pointed this out, other historians have noted that the Virgin Lands campaign has an unhappy ending, not that dissimilar to what happens in the United States during the Dust Bowl. So after these steppe lands, this prairie essentially is plowed up and planted with corn and other feed crops for a number of years, the first few years are pretty successful because that rich land still has a lot of nutrients in it.
But it is also very prone to erosion, and so you see dust storms and a lot of this topsoil just blowing away in this period, which results in huge losses throughout the 1960s, actually, for these regions and many of these virgin lands that were sort of planned and carried out. Ultimately, don't end up lasting for more than 10 or 20 years. They do not become permanent settlements. Essentially, they're failures of the campaign.
We've been speaking a lot about the role that Soviet agriculture played in domestic politics, but what about the geopolitical side of Soviet agriculture? How important was it in the race against the United States through various indices of trying to show success or superiority as a social system?
Well, I think that the Soviet Union, for a period, was in more or less direct competition with the United States. Khrushchev is famous for the phrase that they will catch up and overtake the United States in agricultural production. But in fact, if you look at their actual policies, Khrushchev was an idealist, but he also implemented, especially in the realm of sort of food rather than agriculture, so processed agricultural products, he implements a lot of very realistic strategies to make sure that people in the Soviet Union have enough, to make sure that there won't be devastating famines, that everybody will have access to plenty of calories and even some fun treats every once in a while, like chocolate and ice cream. But, you know, I think there's a general acknowledgement that it will take the Soviet Union quite a while, and maybe never. I'm not sure if that's ever said out loud at any Politburo meetings, but it will take the Soviet Union quite a while to be at the level of the United States. That the most important thing is to make sure that people don't feel like they are making a sacrifice by living in the Soviet Union, to make sure that people feel comfortable, they feel well fed, they feel like they have an access to a variety and a range of products, and that things are getting better rather than worse. I think those are the priorities of this period. So the official rhetoric is one of catch up and overtake, but on the ground things play out a little differently. The food technologists of the Soviet Union are realists, and they improve the Soviet food supply, but they don't necessarily plan on having nearly as many surplus calories or the same level of meat or milk that Americans had access to during this same time.
How important were agricultural exports for the Soviet Union, both in terms of self-image, but also in terms of bringing cash into the Soviet economy?
Well, it varies a lot over time. The Soviet Union leaned pretty heavily on exports of wheat, for example, in the 1920s and 1930s. In the post-war period, these are important to a certain extent, but you know, in the 20s and 30s, the United States is buying some of that wheat. In the post-war period, the United States is not doing any kind of agricultural trade with the Soviet Union. So agricultural exports are less economically central and a little bit more symbolic. So the Soviet Union, for example, sets up a big trade scheme with Cuba, for example, where Cuba sends the Soviet Union sugar, and the Soviet Union sends Cuba mostly wheat, but other grains as well. So that's sort of the classic kind of Cold War era trade agreement that the Soviet Union set up, where they are sort of in solidarity and supporting another communist or socialist state, essentially, and supporting its economy.
The program's Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Jenny Lee Smith about her book, Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. Your story ends, as the title of your book indicates, with the Soviet Union's first major purchase of wheat on the world market, which is wheat from the United States. What led to that point, and how was that received by the Soviet public?
I end in 1963 because this is the first time the Soviet Union does this. The most famous time the Soviet Union purchases wheat from the United States is later. It's in the 70s, 1972. The Great Grain Robbery is an event where this happens. It's very public, and this happens at an especially bad moment during the Cold War, and it's sort of perceived that the Soviet Union has sort of gotten away with something, and that the United States was accidentally tricked into selling its wheat at a low price to the Soviets. One of the reasons I stop in 1963 instead of going all the way to 1972 is just because the Soviet Union started buying wheat in 1963 and had been quietly doing so for most of the other years in the 1960s, on and off. There were some good years where they didn't need to buy wheat on the international market, but for the most part, they were becoming an importer rather than an exporter of wheat during this period. In 1963, this was a non-event in the United States, but for Soviet citizens, this was pretty scarring. And this really led to Khrushchev's downfall. One of the reasons they bought wheat on the market was this was because there had been yet another harvest failure, crop failure in the heartlands of the Soviet Union. And so this was seen as yet another failure on the part of Khrushchev to deliver on his promises of increasing agricultural production throughout the country. So that was really how it was read by Soviet citizens to some extent, but especially to political outsiders, the people who were actually making the decision to throw Khrushchev out of power. The Soviet Union, of course, was calling itself a democracy at this time, but it was not as if Khrushchev was voted out. There was essentially a sort of benevolent coup that took him out of power in 1963. But this was definitely one of the big events that contributed to his ouster at this time.
Well, let's talk about your assessment of the Soviet experience in agriculture, which, as you narrate in your book, changed over time. You say it's very difficult to sort of assess things in terms of simply success or failure. But let me ask you to start by talking about perhaps the most glaring legacy, which was to the environment. What were the ecological consequences of industrialized Soviet agriculture?
It's hard to overestimate them in some places in the Soviet Union. I know, for example, cotton farming in Central Asia, for example, has been this contributed to the death of the Aral Sea, and has been absolutely devastating for both humans who live there and for the environment. I mean, that's essentially becoming a dead space in some ways, and that is definitely part of the Soviet legacy. There was also an incredible amount of waste in Soviet agriculture. So I think this is true in most agricultural systems, but the Soviet Union, the waste level is pretty appalling. Part of this is because, you know, lack of refrigeration or a lack of organization, the sort of command and control methods that the Soviet Union used to ship food around the country or to supply orders to one factory or another factory just led to things like, you know, shipments of fruit rotting in trains and things like that. So it was a highly inefficient system. In defense of the Soviet system, if I may very briefly, it does not compare that badly with the American system, both in terms of waste, but also the Soviet system, partially because they're not especially good at distributing a lot of different kinds of inputs. They never really invest heavily in fertilizers, for example, until very late in the Soviet Union. So for most of this time period, agricultural workers are not spreading, you know, petroleum-based fertilizers across their fields, for example. So there are some ways in which the sort of dysfunctionality of the Soviet system actually serves as something of an environmental protectant. I don't want to say that's always the case at all times, but if you compare Soviet industrialized agriculture to that of other countries, you come up with some interesting case studies where there really are some advantages to their system being a little bit backwards or a little bit behind the times.
Well, what about the things that you saw as conscious innovations? That, in a sense, is almost an accident because, as you write in your book, had they had access to those fertilizers or antibiotics for farm animals, for example, that they probably would have used them following the model they were going on, right?
Oh, absolutely. This is not I mean, it's a bit like Cuban agriculture today. There's no conscious choice to not use fertilizers and pesticides. They just don't have access to these things, so they're not able to use them. So the protective qualities that this has is simply, you know, you can look at it as a form of poverty in the Soviet system, or an oversight in the sort of tiers of development that they're building up as time goes on.
So over a 30-year period, the Soviet Union went from being a very economically underdeveloped, primarily rural country, to an industrialized country, which was an imperial power, which raised the standard of living for the majority of its population. Obviously, that's a mixed legacy in all sorts of ways, but I wonder if you could talk about, looking at agriculture, what you think were the successes over that period of time, and even the innovations that planners were often seen through the lens of the Cold War as being totally misguided, wasteful, foolish, the ways they coped with the kind of challenges that Soviet agriculture faced.
I mean, I would say that the Soviet Union managed to exploit some of its best resources, which were human resources, and that once it realized that, you know, it shouldn't treat the millions and millions of people living in agricultural parts of the Soviet Union as liabilities, but should treat them as an asset, I think that's when the system itself really started to thrive. So you see the Soviet Union turning more towards labor-intensive kinds of agriculture in the 1950s and really even into the 1960s. And in part, this is because of the total devastation of World War II. They really don't have a choice. They don't have machines to fall back on. They don't have machines to replace human labor. But once they do that, there's sort of a cascade of changes. I mean, first of all, they tend to value some of these kinds of work that had perhaps not been so highly valued before. And so people are earning at least slightly better wages, and they're also sort of the virtues of their jobs are being extolled. These also become a way for the Soviet Union to keep better track of its animals and its progress. So one of the things you see a lot of in the 1930s and 1940s is Soviet officials kind of cooking the books. Part of that reason is because there are a lot of people in rural areas dying in the 1930s especially. But even without considering the terrible famine years, there's still, you know, a way in which Soviet officials really don't have a great grasp on what's going on in the countryside. In the 50s and 60s, they sort of come back to the countryside with new eyes and new kinds of ideas about how to manage rural residents and how to best take advantage of them as workers. And that works to their advantage in this period. And it does help to significantly boost the productivity of Soviet agriculture in this period. And it does it without the kind of, you know, terror and civil war that Stalin imposed during the years right after collectivization in the early 1930s. And it does it without resorting to the kind of laissez-faire proto-capitalist system that was in place in the 1920s. So that was one of the main points I wanted to make with this book was simply that that's that is a real achievement, and the Soviet agricultural system has many problems, but that's one thing that I think we can look at and learn from and recognize as a true achievement, their interest in the people on the ground and being able to take advantage of them in the best way.
Well, obviously the Soviet Union is no more. What lessons do you think we can draw from the Soviet experience today in thinking about industrialized agriculture, whether it's in the Soviet Union or elsewhere?
Well, let's see. You know, I'm a historian, so I don't get asked questions like this an awful lot. But, I mean, one thing I would say is, you know, I work in Russia now. It's been a few years since I've been back, but I have spent a fair amount of time there visiting archives and different cities and things like that. And I have to say that I don't know if people are exactly nostalgic for the Soviet state, but there is a way in which an heavy-handed, imposing state, especially the kind that Khrushchev maybe was in charge of in the 50s and 60s, takes better care of rural people, people living outside of big fashionable cities. So there's a way in which some people in the Soviet Union were better taken care of during Soviet times than they are now during Russian times. There's a way in which because the state is smaller, because it's less concerned with, you know, you don't collect your paycheck from the government. You know, there's a lot more private industry in Russia today. But there are a lot more people who have fallen through the cracks. There are a lot more elders who depend on their neighbors to put sacks of buckwheat in front of their apartment doors once a week to help them to help them get enough to eat and things like that. There are a lot of people who've fallen through the cracks in the Russian system. And I don't think people are nostalgic necessarily for the Soviet period, but I do think there is a way in which the Soviet period, especially with food and agriculture, did pay close attention to sort of doing right by its citizens, especially in these post-war years that I focus on.
Jenny Lee Smith has been my guest. She is a historian of technology and the environment. She teaches in the School of History and Sociology at Georgia Institute of Technology. And her book, which we've been discussing in this hour, is Works in Progress, Plans and Realities on Soviet Farms, 1930 to 1963. That's published by Yale University Press. Jenny Lee Smith, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much, Sasha. I enjoyed talking to you.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for joining us, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
Wisconsin Nature Notes from the Nature Conservancy. What is singing, blooming, creeping, and crawling in the Badger State? The first day of spring, or the spring equinox, arrives every year between March 20th and March 22nd, which theoretically means we should experience equal periods of day and night. In northern Wisconsin, though, conditions are not quite so equal. The sun will actually rise near 6:01 a.m. and set near 6:10 p.m., granting us 9 extra minutes of daylight. However, given the usual continuation of winter and cabin fever well into April, no one would dream of complaining about too much light. But spring is on its way. How soon will spring occur in the North Woods compared to southern Wisconsin? Well, we can accurately predict the date of the first bloom of our northern spring flowers based on Hopkins' Law, which says that phenological events vary at the rate of 1 day for each 15 minutes of latitude and 1 day for each 100 feet of altitude. Phenology is the study of the seasonal march of observable biological events. When the first robin returns, when the first trillium blooms, for example. If we compare biological events in Madison to those in Minocqua, there should be a 20-day interval between the two areas, given their distance apart, about 220 miles, and their differences in elevation. So, if a friend in Madison calls to say she saw her first robin on March 1st, folks in the North Woods can expect to see their first robin on the equinox. Note that variations do occur along the Great Lakes where the weather is moderated by the still icy waters, and Hopkins' Law is considered valid only up to June 1st, when other factors take control, like available sunlight, soil conditions, and rainfall. Most importantly, everything is now starting to come to life. Buds are breaking, leaves are popping, flowers unfolding. The great green-up has commenced. Birds, too, are returning, many following the first hatches of insects. Birds that have wintered in Central and South America, however, will wait until late April and early May to return, fully aware of how fickle winter can be. So, while winter lingers, maddening as it often is, it's time to begin watching for the signs of spring. Many migrating birds utilize the Lake Michigan shoreline as their route north. Consider visiting the Nature Conservancy's Mink River Preserve in Door County, where 1,950 acres are protected and 200 species of bird have been counted in migration and nesting. To catch the first wildflowers of the year in southern Wisconsin, try Chewaukee Prairie on Lake Michigan, the last unbroken stretch of prairie of its kind in the state. Chewaukee is home to more than 400 plant species, including shooting stars, prairie violets, and wood betony, which bloom in the spring. Learn how you can take part in conservation in Wisconsin. Go to the Nature Conservancy's website at nature.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Nature Notes is the work of the Nature Conservancy in Wisconsin and Mind's Eye Audio in Madison.